Thank you, Madam Clerk, and welcome everybody to the November 25th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would like a little assistance hearing proceedings in chambers today, we do have hearing assist devices stored at the end of the dais. And with that, if you would all please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, to my knowledge, there are no changes to today's agenda.
That's correct.
We'll do it like we set it up. That brings us then to our consent agenda. I do have two requests to speak. John Wallace, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm here to talk about your item number two on the consent calendar, having to do with the introduction of the groundwater restriction ordinance. As you know, the Pavley and Dickinson bills have been passed by the state and will duplicate some of these efforts. And I was wondering if this could be withheld until we could better analyze some of the requirements of the Sustainability Groundwater Management Act. Also, in terms of the ordinance itself that you're looking at, it's an extremely long permit processing, as I analyzed it, maybe taking up to 6 months to acquire a permit if it has environmental review. And later on, it states that the permit's only good for 1 year. So it would be extremely burdensome to go back to that process after only a one-year period of time. Excuse me. Have a cold this morning. There's also some other restrictions in there about de minimis transfer of groundwater being a half an acre foot. Many ranchers have other houses and ranch quarters scattered across a ranch, maybe overlying two different groundwater basins, where only a half of an acre foot of transfer would be too restrictive. In my letter to the board, I requested that maybe that could be upped to about 10 acre feet per year to provide for livestock as well as domestic use. So contiguous parcels also was a requirement in the ordinance. And often there's a gap, be it a road right-of-way or another parcel intervening between contiguous parcels that would allow for an exemption. So I think some of these things need to be studied a little bit more before you introduce the ordinance. I know that it would come back to you for a full discussion, but I think there's enough about it now that would need some further study before you introduce that ordinance. So I recommend that you postpone the introduction to a later time after further study. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Ms. Owen. Ms. Owen speaking on item 26. Seeing her, she's right there. One more time. We'll go ahead and ask Ms. Owen if she'd like to come in and speak to 26.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I wanted to speak on consent item number 26. It's the discussion of the leak in the Nacimiento pipeline that has basically shut down delivery of water to all the participating agencies. That includes Paso Robles, Templeton, Atascadero, Takes, to handle this emergency that's been going on since June 2nd was the beginning of this. I just want to say, how long is this going to take? And I really certainly hope that we do not make other communities dependent on that water source, because it's not a good one. It's not reliable. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. That was our last request to speak on the consent agenda, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board, ask colleagues for items to pull. Ms. Ray.
No.
Mr. Meacham.
Number two and a comment on 26.
Mr. Hill.
Comment on 29, please.
And Ms. Arnold.
No.
No. I am going to recuse on item 15. I have a potential, though not financial, conflict with within one of the bargaining units, so I will not be voting on item 15. So I'm going to ask that to be pulled for a separate vote. With that, Mr. Meacham on item number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to agree with Mr. Wallace. I went back and listened to the tapes of the meeting that we held when we introduced the discussion about this and listened to what Supervisor Hill had to say. I think he made some pretty good points. And after looking through this, which started out to be a simple suggestion, I think good intentions, but as we all know, the road to hell is paved with them, I think that this is not ready yet. And I would just as soon wait to even introduce this until we have a little bit more clarity in terms of what Pavley Dickinson's going to recommend in its regulations and its rules. And as we move towards the urgency ordinance expiration in the 27th of August, so I'm going to ask that we not introduce this for reading at this particular point in time and ask this to be pulled for a separate vote.
All right. We'll take that as a separate vote then. Let's go through other items, and you had mentioned number 26.
Item number 26, yeah. Comment made about the lake being so low. Yes, the lake is at 16-17%. There's still 62,000 acre-feet of water there. The amount of water that's available to San Luis Obispo County is not in jeopardy in terms of its the levels there. And as far as its unreliability, it has never not been able to provide the amount of water that San Luis Obispo has subscribed to. So I know that there's concern about this being fixed. We're going to get this fixed. Why is it taking so long? There's a lot of investigative work that had to be done. But in addition to that, it's been referenced the fact that we're going to have this online by April 1st. That's the date.
All right. Very good. And then Ms. Arnold on number 29.
No, that was me, I think.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hill. You're somewhere to my left here. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 29 is another one of the funding for homeless services and so forth. And I just want to say, as I've said in other times when we've seen items, probably right now going into this next year, we are seeing more funding for addressing homelessness than ever before, from federal and state agencies, and also from the county. The county's put a lot of money into commitment, and so I want to once again express the need for us. I know we're going to have reports back on the 50 now to the board and other things, but because there's so much money being put out there now, I think it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we have reports. And I know I've talked with Dan about this. I've talked with Lee at Social Services and Jeff and Robin too, which is for us to really look closely both internally and with, as this is an example, with our partner agencies, and make sure that we have a good sense, that we have good metrics for success and failure, that we have a real good accounting of how monies are spent, what's working, what's not working, because I don't want us to find ourselves in 2 years saying we spent a lot of money, we did the easy things, and now we don't know what's next. And so I really think it's critical with the amount of money that's being put out there that we ask from our agencies too, our partner agencies outside of the county, that they provide the kind of accounting and metrics that we should expect. Because I know at some point the community is going to say, okay, all this money's been spent. Is the problem in our entire county, north to south? Has there been a true impact? Are we seeing less people on the streets, less social costs, less transient problems, less of those things that everybody understands? So it's just really, every time these things come up, I want to emphasize that. So that's my comment, sir.
That comment. All right. Thank you. With no further discussion, then, I would entertain a motion on consent absent items 2 and 15.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Ms. Ray. A roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Is there a motion, then, on item number 2?
On item number 2, I'll make a motion that we defer consideration on this.
Restrictions placed on our property owners throughout the Paso Basin and many other areas of the county. And while that is going on, I think we at least need to have a mechanism in place to be able to address and be able to take a look before we allow any exportation of groundwater out of these basins that are being called level severity three. So I think it's absolutely important that we put something in place now. Other counties in the state have had exportation of groundwater going on while the supervisors are just wringing their hands because they have no mechanism in place to address it, and it's just happening without without the consent and sometimes detrimental to the folks that live in the particular county. So I would like to see this stay on the agenda for a hearing and address the problems, or at least have the opportunity to discuss and debate the importance of having an ordinance. I'd like to see it stay on.
Thank you. Mr. Hill?
Yeah, to speak to that, and I appreciate what Supervisor Arnold's saying, but I guess I side with Supervisor Meacham in terms of wanting to get this right. And the main reason why it doesn't, you know, it's just not as pressing as it might seem, is the infrastructure that is required to actually do something like exporting groundwater is just enormous, and there's nothing remotely close to that possibility happening. So from my perspective, what Supervisor Meacham's asking for, which is, you know, let's make sure before we even get into the debate about whether we're going to pass this or not, that it is, you know, it sufficiently addresses all the issues that we want. And I don't think that by getting it right, we're going to somehow see things happen that's going to export groundwater. I agree with the concerns about wanting to make sure that we have one of these in place, but, you know, I'm okay with making sure that we get it right.
Ms. Meacham? And then back to Ms. Arnold.
And Supervisor Arnold, I agree that something needs to be addressed and something needs to be done. But I can remember very, very clearly one of the last comments that was made from the public was, you guys need to get this right. I don't think this is right yet. And the other thing, when you're talking about a lot of land restrictions, you're talking about some pretty heavy-duty land use restrictions if infrastructure needs to be put in place to do something like this. So I think it needs further consideration. That's all I'm asking for. I'm not saying that this should go away completely, but I think based upon all of the letters that we got back from all the different agencies, none of them supported it. And so I think that giving this a little more time would be a benefit to us.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes, and I respectfully disagree. First of all, if no one's planning on exporting, then this should be just kind of a precautionary measure that we take, that we have it in place. Secondly, it's not a ban. It's the ability for the county to take a look when someone is planning for an exportation, planning for exportation. We would be taking a look and ensuring that that would not be detrimental to the neighboring property owners. The fact that everyone says it takes a long time and this and that, there are plenty of pipelines in the ground that could be easily retrofitted to make it possible to move groundwater around. Again, I'm all about supporting the movement of surface water. That's what it's there for us to have supplemental water supplies and to be used countywide if necessary. This is groundwater coming out of basins that everyone on this dais was calling a crisis situation in several different areas of the county. We're telling people that we're in a crisis with our groundwater. We're telling property owners they can't do anything with their property, and we're not willing to say, you know what, we don't know what the future holds, but right now we're going to put something in place that allows us to take a look and require permission to be able to export groundwater. I don't know what the big deal is. Why can't we have that? We can adjust it. We can amend ordinances. But at least if we have the groundwork in place, it's there. It's not going to happen ahead of us. We will have the opportunity to say, hey, hold on, we want to take a look at this first.
Ms. Ray?
Won't we have that opportunity via CEQA anyway?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
That's my point. I think Supervisor Hill's observation about the lack of infrastructure to do any significant amount of exportation is important. Yes, there are oil pipelines in the ground, but that does not make them groundwater exportation devices. Our groundwater is in serious trouble in many places in this county, so I don't see that there's groundwater to export. The situation here, very different from, for instance, Stanislaus County, where I talked to county supervisors last week, where there are canals and pipes and proximity to other counties that just doesn't exist here. So I'm all for getting it right. I'm not too concerned with the way this ordinance is crafted right now, but if colleagues are interested in further consideration, I don't think there's any downside to that. I just don't see the threat here as being significant.
Situation. If we're going to allow or want to have some kind of control over exporting groundwater, the last drought in the 80s, and I'll admit I wasn't paying as much attention as I do today, but we were this close before that drought broke to people really talking seriously about using existing pipelines that had been in the ground, that were available, empty, retrofitting those for the movement of groundwater. And I'm just saying, if we as a board hadn't created policy that restricted the people's use of their property and their groundwater, so they own the property, their groundwater use is restricted, and we are not ensuring that exportation is at least addressed by the board. I feel like we're being irresponsible.
You bring up an interesting point. I did talk to council yesterday. It is possible for this board to articulate a policy that that is something to the effect that it's this board's policy that we will not support exportation of our groundwater to the net detriment of the county. And council indicates we could pass a resolution that would articulate that policy position, which would be something we could do very quickly if that were the pleasure of the board. But again, I don't know what Supervisor Meacham thinks in terms of time for crafting what changes he might make. He is up next in the discussion. I would let him speak to them.
And again, Supervisor Arnold, this, I don't believe that this is taking away the framework for the discussion on this. I just don't think that we've got it right at this particular point in time. And there's been a lot of suggestions that's been submitted by all the different agencies that will be affected by this. But if you really want to do a policy, all you got to do is look at the findings required for export permit approval. Item A, 1 through 7, overdone. I mean, we're making this more complicated, and in so doing, it's creating more questions. So I think that we can get this right by taking a little bit more time. I'm not in a hurry because, absolutely, there is a drought. I don't know anybody that's going to be exporting any water any soon because there isn't any to export. So I just want to be able to get this to where we can make sure we're not going to be, number one, challenged in court, and number two, we're not affecting people that shouldn't be affected by this.
So I would suggest, unless there's other comments to be made, that we vote the question.
Call the question.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
I know.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And with that, I'd entertain a motion on item 15.
So moved.
Second.
I had it as 15. Is it 15? It is 15. And so, Madam Clerk, roll call on that, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Abstain. So that concludes consent. With that, we come to public comment for items not on the agenda and within the purview of the Board of Supervisors. I have six requests to speak at the dais. Seeing no one else interested, we'll go with these six requests. We'll start with Eric Greening, followed by David Weissman.
I'm Eric Greening, and now that number two is off calendar, I guess I will address it on my way to addressing another issue. A better option, if this isn't gotten right, would be to agendize it, and I ask you to do that for a date certain. You'll have to do it next week. You'll have to agendize it for some future meeting for recrafting, not for adoption, and make it specifically clear that this would not be adopted at this hearing, but that it would be an opportunity to discuss the contents of it. I don't see how it's going to get right just sitting there waiting for another date to be heard. So in any event, that way everybody would, it would be a place you could have come together on how to handle this, and hopefully still will. so that it doesn't completely go away and doesn't stay not right, but just get adopted later and maybe too late. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to talk about was a decision you had made that at the time seemed simple, but now includes a lot more work for you. And that was the decision to become the applicants at LAFCO for the district in the Paso Robles groundwater basin. The LAFCO meeting last week was very interesting. I know the two members were at CSAC, and so Frank Meacham represented you in absentia as an alternate. But here is what the county is going to have to come up with. And the reason for doing this district was so the county wouldn't have to make decisions like that made by the three supervisors not from the basin. I'm afraid it's not getting you there. Here is, you're going to be coming up with a description of the services to be provided by the new district, the boundary of the district, the level and range of those services. There's a lot that needs to be gotten right by someone.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Weissman, followed by Ben DeFatto.
Good morning, Supervisors. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. And I'm going to use the imaginary time machine this morning to take us back. It was exactly 5 years ago this very morning that we awoke and found a Tribune headline, Pacific Gas and Electric applies to relicense the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. 5 years ago today that appeared, and with it foretold, of course, that this relicensing and the process would bring economic benefits to San Luis County, its residents, and its infrastructure and economy for many years to come. But now we're 5 years down the road. In fact, we're 2 years past what was even their conservative estimate of the time in which this would have actually been a fait accompli. And so I think maybe on this somewhat anniversary, we take a look back and realize why perhaps now that goal is even more elusive than it was 5 years ago. We know that PG&E asked for $85 million in ratepayer funding to fund the application and was rejected by the Public Utilities Commission, which has told them that if they want to apply again, they can't simply submit the old application again, have to redo it with all new numbers. Fukushima happened, and after that, the utility itself voluntarily put its relicensing application on hold with the NRC. The utility had gone ahead and applied for relicensing without completing the state's mandated seismic studies. Those are now, of which Dr. Gibson's a participant, being reviewed, finally, 5 years after the time when they should have had them done. We know that the State Water Board is now considering quite seriously the prohibition on once-through cooling. The Water Board met last week, and the budgets presented for the alternatives ranged from $1.6 to $14 billion over a decade in time. The board is expected to rule sometime in 2015 on whether PG&E will be required to comply and whether they'll be able to afford to. The NRC also told PG&E that they needed to address the Coastal Commission's federal equivalency permit for this relicensing, and they haven't done so far. In fact, correspondence with the Coastal Commission indicates that PG&E has not yet met with them to even begin discussing this. The NRC has said, we need to know by December 31st, what's your schedule? Because we need to know whether we'll have staff standing by to continue this license application or not. All of this, I would think, would give the County of San Luis pause to once again consider investigating an economic future in absence of Diablo Canyon as it applies to the budget for the schools particularly. We've had the four unexpected closures of reactors due principally to economic or other reasons within the past couple of years that cause effects in their community. And I think this anniversary gives the county pause to take a look at this and consider that the potential that was expressed 5 years ago and that optimism may be fading quickly for a utility facing billions of dollars in federal and state fines for blowing up San Bruno as well. So once again, bring that up. If I might quickly, a quick public service announcement for the traveling public. In my other hat as the Amtrak volunteer host, Thanksgiving weekend, the biggest travel weekend of the year at Amtrak, just letting San Luis residents who are watching and listening know, the lot at Amtrak is already almost full. If you're planning on traveling by train this weekend, have someone drop you off at the station at least an hour in advance. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Weissman. Mr. DeFatto, followed by Chuck Sasania.
Good morning. Ben DeFatto here. Today my comments are about power to the people. A huge phenomenon happened at the last election a few weeks ago in this nation, states, and county. We just saw what the will of the people are looking for, honesty and transparency, and for all politicians to protect, serve, and have open government and what's best for its citizens. Some of you sitting up there should pay strict attention to these changes that are coming your way by a new wave of people who let you have your way far too long and like your purview. The big spender in Sacramento wants to build a high-speed rail from Bakersfield to Sacramento at our expense of hundreds of billions that 99% of us will never ride on it. You just saw the city of Rio Grande upset an incumbent, dethroned, and dishonored for trying to help one of the good old boys by trying to deceit, lie, and cover up a violation of some of the HR department rules which could have been resolved with a few months of leave without pay or a demotion. But no, the good old boys wanted to protect him, even when some speakers at this lecture wanted to give you in this county some sound advice, but you saying it was not in your purview to speak about it made some in AG even madder. Your motto in this county should be, if you think it's wrong, well, it probably is. You know, the people and businesses of Arroyo Grande saw right through you trying to save a good old boy by you not allowing public comment about AG. Why, I even said that those two have suffered enough and just give them some time off and we can go into the next crisis. But it was probably too late. The cover-up had already...
Good morning, Board. My name's Chuck Cicini. I'm a resident of Los Osos. I wanted to talk today again about water conservation. We have our updated 2014 seawater intrusion monitoring report that's just been released right after the election, curiously. The conclusions are that nothing has changed since 2005. Saltwater is still intruding into Zone E at 250 feet a year. In spite of all the conservation that we've done nothing to slow the advance of saltwater intrusion. It's coming into Zone D. We've already shut off access to Zone E at the main CSD well next to the library. To recap, we've got three main aquifer layers. You know, so Zone C is where the nitrates are. We're denitrifying at the wellhead because we don't have time to wait for a treatment project to cure that. Zone E, we're shutting off access to Zone E because of saltwater intrusion, and within 5 years, we're shutting off access to Zone D at the CSD's main well, unless something changes. Why am I approaching you about water conservation? Because you have $5 million budgeted in the wastewater project for water conservation. It's a requirement of the coastal development permit. To date, a fraction of that's been spent, maybe 22%. I'll also be handing you, in addition to a copy of the saltwater intrusion assessment, a little report card on the conservation efforts that have been going on, which shows that we're reached a target of 7% of the estimated number of washing machines that we needed to replace, that kind of thing. Why aren't washers included in the mandatory retrofit before you hook up to the sewer? I mean, you have to trade out your toilets, your shower heads. Why not washers? Washing machines are a very heavy user of water. That should be part of that program. And the other reason I want to talk to you about conservation, in addition to the fact that you've got a requirement in the coastal development permit, is that the water purveyors don't seem that interested. Golden State has done nothing except implement the state's mandated regulations. The CSD can't even talk in their little staff summary about the seawater intrusion assessment reaching our 10th Street well a month ago when they set their own water conservation targets. We had five layers, all with the metrics that were going to be triggered by weather and so forth. According to their own metrics, we're at level five. We should be implementing a Cambria-type conservation and rationing program, but we didn't want to upset the people because they're paying for sewer, they're upset about the sewer construction, so we set it at level two. The CSD and the Golden State just have no interest in water conservation, and I ask you to please take the lead on that. And you may have to because of the groundwater laws that were passed. The basin that's under adjudication doesn't match the basin limits.
Thank you, Mr. Cicena. Mr. Margetson, followed by Lindy Owen.
R- Richard Margetson. I'm going to follow up on a little bit of what Chuck talked about. It is interesting, I think, that this report actually wasn't revealed to the public till after the election in Los Osos, but Chuck still got elected in what some of the press called an upset. He was a member of the recall board. Since the inception of the CSD in the late 90s, consumption in the CSD Water District, which is about half of the consumption in the community, is about half of what it was at the inception of the district. The district was consuming about 400 million gallons a year. It looks like this year, if everything holds to the trend for this year, it looks like it'll be just around 200 million gallons. But seawater intrusion, 60 acre feet a year at the inception of the district, is now at 250 feet inward movement per year. Kind of interesting. This report, when you read it, and I hope you read it, it's only 10 pages, a lot of it's pictures. The first page has a paragraph that talks about, in 2009, the seawater front has extended into the district's Palisades well, which is by the community center. It is now known that the seawater in the Palisades well originated from Zone E, which is the deepest portion of the lower aquifer. In 2013, the Palisades well was modified to remove the Zone E influence, and seawater is no longer evident in the well. You know how that was accomplished? They put a cement slurry down.
That is our only gauge to see how fast we're losing our basin. Unfortunately, the private wells, we have absolutely zero information on. Now, I know that's a touchy subject, but there's no reason that we could not set up a program to put in meters on those wells only for readout of how much they're using. Their right to use it is their right. But for the users of a basin to all work together for solution is going to require that metering on those wells, that data is essential to understanding how you're going to take care of a basin. Los Osos, as you watch, on one end they're pulling it out, on the other end the ocean is moving in. When that is all finished and done in maybe 10 to 20 years, we will have zero water in Los Osos. It's clear that we've overpopulated our area and our resource is diminishing. I really urge a program that start looking at these, at the private wells, to just get the information. That's all we need. It's known that they usually reduce by 20% their usage once they're part of a problem and they join in. I wanted to talk about the Wallace Group. I just urge that you stop sole sourcing with Wallace Group. They've been involved. They have a footprint, many issues relating to water, and I see that they continue to be used, and I think it's time to open up the field and look at some other sources. We've got a number of problems with mismanagement and overcharging. I then wanted to go to talking about, I don't know if you're aware, but if you live in Los Osos, every morning you're greeted by gunshot echoes all over the bay. The hunting has started again. It usually goes on for, I think, 4 months during the winter and spring. It's insane. There is no reason for hunting to occur in an estuary that is protected. It's a bird sanctuary in Morro Bay. There are kayakers. We have all kinds of recreational use. There are animals that rely on being able to stop and rest on their migration paths, and the brant geese are one of them. But it's okay to go out and shoot them. It's okay to have kayakers nearby while you are shooting. I urge you to please step up. It's been asked many times, but it's time to put a complete ban on hunting with bullets in the bay. And lastly, I wanted to just propose the question. I see we have no sheriff here today, but several meetings back, I was falsely accused of an outburst, and Mr. Gibson asked the sheriff to remove me. I went on my own, but I just wonder if you might address how you would look at those issues in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close public comment. Item's not on the agenda. And ask Madam Clerk to introduce our first item of business.
Item number 32, submittal of the fiscal year 2014-2015 first quarter financial report and a request to approve various financial actions as detailed in Section 4 of the report, all districts.
Thank you. Ms. Brown.
Good morning. I'm Leslie Brown with the County Administrative Office. I have a presentation for you, please. Okay. So I'm here to present a very quick presentation on the status of the first quarter report, or the first quarter of the fiscal year. This is a chart that you've seen many times. This shows the overall expenditure and revenue patterns for the quarter as compared to the same time period in the prior year. As you can see at the top half of the chart, expenditure and revenue patterns for the first quarter for all funds was fairly consistent to the same time last year. And then for the general fund, the bottom half of the chart, expenditures are fairly consistent. However, you'll notice that revenue is slightly lower than the levels in the first quarter of last year, and this is primarily due to a timing of posting of current unsecured taxes. So this is just a timing issue. This is not an expectation that this revenue will come in under. This represents about a $2.2 million difference in what was posted compared to prior year. Overall, departments are reporting that their budgets are on track to end the fiscal year either below general fund support or at general fund support. I do have a few issues that I want to summarize with you. The first is not really an issue. This is a good thing. Prop 172, which is the half-cent sales tax that the counties and cities receive for public safety, is coming in higher than historical levels, and this is primarily because of the two large solar plants that have been constructed out in the Carrizo Plain. Several million dollars in sales tax has been spent to construct these two projects. Amounts that the county has received, this is total county receipts, so it includes the amounts that the cities receive too, which is actually a very small portion. It's about 4.5% or so. So the amounts that you see are actual amounts that were received up until fiscal year 13-14, and then the dotted line at the top for the green is just our forecasted amount of what we expect to receive in the next few years. The red line is the amount that we expect we would have received if we were receiving historical levels based on our allocation factor. So the amount that's actually been included in the budgets for the four public safety departments that receive this revenue is the amount that you see in the red dotted line. And the difference is the amount that we're asking to be set aside in the new designation. This is actually an issue that we've reported to your board over the last fiscal year. The trend of recording revenue coming in at lower levels than in the past is still going on. In fact, compared to the first quarter of 2013-14, recording revenue is about 21% lower, about $35,000, than the same period last year. Apparently, the housing market has been stagnating, and recording activity is low. However, with housing prices stabilizing, there's a hope that housing activity or purchases will pick up again, and if they don't, the clerk is anticipating they could see a shortfall of approximately 141,000 at year end. The clerk reports that they can mitigate this by reassigning staff to duties that are covered by restricted revenue that's held in a trust. So this should not have an impact on the general fund. And this is one of the more significant issues that I've included in the report. As you know, the county contracts with CAL FIRE to provide fire service for the county. The budget for that is approximately $15.7 million. When we put our budgets together, typically the state hasn't finalized their rates. which was the case in fiscal year 14-15. And in September, there were two actions that were taken at the state that will impact the rates for CAL FIRE employees. And the first is an increase in the CalPERS employee benefits rates based on assumptions that CalPERS made. And this could result in an increase in unbudgeted expenditures of about $406,000. And the second is an increase in firefighter compensation. So this was spurred by the increase in the state minimum wage because firefighter one salaries are pegged to the minimum wage. And so when the increase went into effect, this triggered collective bargaining, and at issue in the discussions was a potential compaction with firefighter two salaries. So there needs to be a meaningful difference in compensation between the two levels if there's a difference in duties required and experience required. And so as a result of the collective bargaining, firefighter two salaries were increased by approximately 6%. So with those two, both those two changes will go into effect or were retroactive to July 1st of this fiscal year. And then in addition, there is another 4% salary increase for all firefighters, which will go into effect January 1st of 2015. So in total, the employee compensation increases will potentially increase expenses about $358,000, and that's on the high end. And the reason why is because CAL FIRE budgets all of their salaries at the top step level. However, all employees are not actually at this top step level, so there is expected to be some savings. And CAL FIRE expects that they will be able to either generate enough expenditure savings or unanticipated revenue to cover any impacts that these two changes will have. And the reason why we think that's possible is in fiscal year 13-14, CAL FIRE actually returned about $870,000 to the general fund due to expenditure savings. And just as a heads up, there is another $1 per hour increase in the state minimum wage that will be going into effect next fiscal year, and we're uncertain exactly what the impacts will be for that. And finally, there are three updates that I've included in the report. The first one is on Camp Mabel French, the 100-acre group camp facility. Finally, I wanted to report on golf. Golf is facing some challenges. This is an enterprise budget. And we run three golf courses to generate revenue to pay for the golf or to fund the golf budget, which include Dairy Creek, Chalk Mountain, and Morrow Bay. Overall, golf rounds are down about 13% compared to the first quarter of last fiscal year, and this is driven by the golf rounds at Dairy Creek Golf Course, which are down about 38%. This is primarily due to the dry conditions out there with the due to the drought and also a reduction in effluent water that's transferred to Dairy Creek from CMC. Basically, what they're doing is watering the greens but not around the peripheral area. Also, the concessionaire at Dairy Creek, Fairway Incorporated, is no longer providing concessionaire services, and so the county staff have taken over responsibility for that until they can find a new vendor for that. And finally, while the budget projected a positive cash flow for golf, they are now expecting that expenditures could exceed revenues by about $198,000, and given that this is an enterprise fund, this is not expected to affect the general fund, and they will address this through expenditure savings as needed. So there are a list of recommendations for your board. Of course, receive and file the report, and there's a budget adjustment included to bring $750,000 in home funds back into the community development budget. This was money that had been intended for a purchase of a low-income site in Cambria. And those funds, due to timing issues, those funds were taken back from that project and will be repurposed for a people's self-help housing project, the Cortland Street Apartments. We're also, again, asking for the board to approve a budget adjustment and create the new Prop 172 solar designation to set those funds aside for future use. We have $21,000 approximately in gift funds for the library and social services. Your board is being asked by the Department of Social Services to discharge almost $21,000 in bad debt that they've deemed uncollectible. We're also asking the board to approve an amendment to the fleet asset list to add a replacement van for social services. The van was destroyed when a tree fell on it. And finally, we're asking the board to declare 42 vehicles as surplus and to authorize their disposal. With that, if you have any questions.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Brown? Seeing none, I will open it to the public, although I have no request to speak on this item, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board.
Move staff's recommendation.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Mr. Hill. Thanks, staff, for bringing this information to us and in passing, or a little bit more than just in passing. Thanks again to those who contribute to both our library and our social service funds. There's always an item on these quarterly reports indicating our acceptance of those gift funds, for which we are most grateful. With that, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. And Madam Clerk, the next item.
Item number 33, review of the fiscal year 2015-2016 budget goals and policies, budget balancing strategies and approaches, and board priorities, all districts.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Ms. Jackson.
Thank you. Can you pull up? Thank you. Good morning. I'm Emily Jackson from the County Administrative Office, here to present your annual review of the budget goals and policies, budget balancing strategies and approaches, and board priorities for the coming year. We'll be kicking off development of our 15-16 budget here in a few weeks, and so this is an appropriate time for you guys to give us some policy direction with respect to that. So, like I said, these are the three areas that we're going to be covering this morning, and this is what we do every year. We'll start off with the budget goals and policies. Some of you may recall that we did a pretty significant overhaul of our budget goals and policies a few years ago. We broke the policies up into the five categories that are listed on this slide, and the intent of doing that was to clarify and provide sort of greater context to each of the individual policies. This is something that was recommended by the Government Finance Officers Association as a best practice to comply with established public management best practices. And so, like I said, that's kind of the direction that we've been headed with our goals and policies in the last couple of years. And the reason that we reaffirm these goals and policies each year is really twofold. The first is that our policies have really provided a very sound framework for our strategic and sort of long-term approach to balancing our budget in the recent years. But they're also general enough that I think they serve us well moving into what we're looking towards in the next couple of years of being better financial times. And so they promote, you know, sort of a balanced approach to building back our budget. That was a policy that we added a few years back. And so despite the fact that they've really kind of helped us get through the economic downturn, we feel like we're in a good position moving forward as well. And then secondly, our budget goals and policies just seek to maintain our good financial position. They support our good bond ratings. And help us to maintain and manage any potential risks that we may encounter in the coming years. So the second piece of this is our budget balancing strategies and approaches. As you're all aware, fiscal year 15-16 will be the first year that we are technically out of our 7-year pain management plan. This graphic, I think, is probably familiar to most of you at this point, and it provides a good representation of the basis for the plan and the budget balancing strategies and approaches that we've used. They're focused really on taking a multi-year approach, or they were focused on taking a multi-year approach to closing the budget gap, and they also included a judicious use of our short-term options for closing the budget gap, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But this graphic really represents, at least over the past 4 or 5 years, how we close that gap. The gap amount is on the right-hand side of the graphic, and then the percentage in the middle is the percentage of long-term versus short-term approaches, or I'm sorry, short-term versus long-term approaches that were taken in each year. So I'll just touch quickly on what some of those approaches were. The preparation of the budget every year is done in line with your board's priorities. The budget is priority-driven. A lot of other counties that we've seen have not taken a very proportional reduction to balancing their budget. That was something that we did. And that means that all departments participate, and that reductions in growth, we try to make sure proportionate to really what's going on. We pay attention to how much a budget has grown or shrunk in the last several years, and we try to make reductions in line with that. Mid-year reductions were something that have happened in a couple of the past years due to actions taken at the state level that we weren't able to anticipate during time of budget preparation. Despite the fact that we're moving out of the recession, that's something that we would continue to do if there were actions at the state or federal level that impacted our budget. And then I think the other important one up here to talk about is that we really made an effort to engage our employee associations, given that salary and benefit costs make up about 60% of our budget, trying to find ways to sort of control that escalating cost have been important and have been hugely useful to us in the last several years. In terms of the short-term approaches, as you're all aware, there was a hiring chill that was in place for a number of years. Unlike a lot of other counties, we did not have to completely freeze positions. They were evaluated on a case-by-case basis with an attention to impacts to service levels being a high priority. We reduced our general fund contingencies. The historical norm and our target has been to keep them at 5%. We reduced them to 4% for a number of years, and just this year we bumped them back up to 4.5%, which again I think points towards improving economic conditions that we're able to do that. And then we, over several years, made some reductions to the amount that we allocated to some of these various funds related to building maintenance and organizational development, though those continued to be high priorities because those are things that, if reduced too much, have a longer cost in the long run. The other short-term approaches were to offer voluntary time off, or in some cases to require voluntary time off to be taken by county employees. We used federal stimulus funding. That's no longer available. And in 1 year offered some retirement incentives and then drew on our reserves a bit in years, though that was minimal. Approaches that were not included were included mandatory time off, furloughs, which a lot of other cities and counties had to do. Many other governments have had to close their doors on some. And on the operational end of things, the board has in the past identified public safety as a priority. And when we talk about public safety, we talk about the sheriff, the district attorney, probation, and county fire. And so over the last several years, we've tried to keep those departments in mind and the priority of those departments in mind as we've looked for ways to reduce the budget. And, you know, despite the fact that we're not looking at having to reduce the budget in the coming years, I think it's still important that we identify some priority areas for funding in the future. So that's what the priorities are now, and we would appreciate any comment or direction with respect to any potential changes to priorities as we move into budget development for fiscal year 15-16.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Questions from the board? Seeing none, I'll open it to the public. I have one request to speak, Mike Brown.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. In terms of the risks and so forth, we wish you'd take some time to talk about some of the things, the what-ifs, such as what happens if PG&E decides not to pursue relicensing, or if the rail spur and so forth doesn't get through, and something happens to the Phillips 66 plant, which is a nice piece of general revenue and employment here. Your smart growth plan, as your consultants have told you, requires ultimately $409 million of infrastructure in the target communities of San Miguel, Templeton, Oceano, and Napomo to have the infrastructure that requires. And how does that relate to the budget, and where is that going to come from? Are you going to take advantage of the ballot or the ledge program result that you can now try to get people to tax themselves in the unincorporated area for this stuff? You know, it looks like on item 15, which was the raises for the managers and executives, which, by the way, we don't disagree with. They didn't get anything since 2008. But it looks like that's a compounded 5% when you take into account the retroactive back to July, and then another one on July 1st. So, and as it points out, SLOSIA, the big part of SLOSIA is not done, and what are they going to, what happens to these budget projections if they get a couple of 5% or something in there? Those kind of things need to be discussed. The other thing, we wish you'd take some time at this part of the year and talk about how you use the budget. Your staff does a lot of work. Some parts of it are advanced compared with a lot of counties. But you're budgeting at the department level. You give a little bit of information at the division level and none at the program level, but the program is the factory floor. And we think you need to budget at all three levels and attach your performance measures. And so you need at this part of the year to talk about some of those things before you get into the substance.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. That was our only request to speak, and seeing no one else coming forward, I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board. No lights on the dais here, so let me only comment that I really appreciate staff bringing the goals and policies, strategies and approaches to us every year. It was this framework that led us through the pain plan, and some seven or more of my 8 years here have been covered by that pain plan. And as we seem to be coming out of it, my mantra to the admin office has been that we need to be as strategic in the expansion as we were in the contraction, and they've only heard me say that probably 7,000 times at this point. But I think the yearly review of these items is a good one. It sets our mind right for what we have to deal with. And with that, I would entertain a motion to approve the goals, policies, strategies, and approaches.
I will, Mr. Chair, I will be happy to move, and I join you and just point out one other thing that that Ms. Jackson pointed out, too. While we are continuing to figure out how best to deal with some of the
from $30 million deficit to where we are today, wasn't because of us. It was because of a lot of work with everybody else to try to get there. We didn't get here by and not get a AAA rating in our bonds by not paying attention to the budget and paying attention to what we're trying to get to. And again, my job is basically a temporary one. These are your careers. And so we have to try to figure out ways that we
protect the county overall in the years to come. So my hat's off to staff. I think we're moving along in the right direction.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold?
Yes, and I, too, want to commend the staff, all the county staff, all the departments, for your diligence and your fiscal responsibility through the recession. It was a remarkable accomplishment to be able to keep the budget under control during the wildly fluctuating revenues and expenditure cycles that we've experienced over so many years now. We're getting used to it. But the one policy that I'm willing to absolutely adopt these policies, but just the one thing that I have a little bit of concern about is the policy, the full cost recovery, which makes total sense with our county government and our fiscal responsibility and balancing our budgets here at the county. But as policymakers, we're not only responsible, or I feel we're not only responsible for a sound fiscal policy here in county government, but also creating policies that create a sound economic base for our constituents, both businesses and the people that work and live here in the county. So with the full cost recovery policy, that's pretty easy, and a lot of businesses use the model. You just transfer your costs to the consumer or the constituent, in our case, the constituent. So for me, I think we need to take a really hard look at that so that we're not just accepting. Some things are out of our control, and we'll be talking about this in our next hearing item when we talk about fees. Some things are out of our control, and it may be appropriate to just pass the costs on, but we need to keep in mind that every fee that we increase is got a trickle-down effect, and it's costing consumers, it's costing all kinds of people, creating increases in their household budgets as well. So full cost recovery, I understand it, but I think it's there may be times when we just need to question, can something else be done to keep the costs down? Can we find ways to be more efficient so those we don't just pass it on through a fee increase? So that's my comment. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And again, thanks to staff. In particular, I think since the last time you were on the dais, you've been officially named as the principal analyst in charge of the budget within the admin office. We look forward to seeing you again and as we move forward. With that, I think we'll just take this on a voice vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, none. Thanks again. Madam Clerk, item 34, please.
Item 34, a hearing to consider an ordinance implementing the county fee schedule A for calendar year 2015 and fee schedule B for fiscal year 2015-16, all districts.
Mr. Cohn, good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson. Mr. Board, I'm Robert Cohn.
To your left.
I apologize. Good morning, Chairman Gibson and the Board. I'm Robert Cohn from the County Administrative Office. I'm here to present the 2015-16 proposed fee schedule. We'll begin by discussing the purpose of fees. Government jurisdictions establish and collect fees as allowed by law. In most instances, the revenue generated by fees helps to either provide a service that may not be required or might not otherwise be funded without fees, such as the county's golf program, for example, facility rentals, business licenses, and pet adoption fees. So I'll begin by discussing the process. Departments annually conduct a review of their fees based upon one of the following methods. They can do an actual cost. This is the preferred and most commonly used method. Departments use the cost accounting system to determine historical costs to deliver a service. They can use time and motion studies. These are used when there is a large volume of services provided, and calculating the cost of each is impractical. An average hourly rate is applied to the typical time it takes to deliver the service. Many departments, such as the Treasurer's Office, do time and motion studies each year to determine the cost of their services. And the third method is a comparable fee survey. This is used when other methods are impractical or when the department wants to ensure that their fees are in line with neighboring counties, agencies, or businesses that offer the same program or service. It comes from fees and permits. This is in line with the historical average. In 13-14 and 14-15, it was 9% of total revenue. This is a comparison of some benchmark counties and how much total revenue they receive from their fees and permits. As you can see, San Luis Obispo here is the lowest at 8%, as we're projecting. Placer and Napa are at 10. Santa Cruz is bumped up to 16. Then we've got Santa Barbara and Monterey at the high end there at 28 and 30% of their total revenue coming from fees. So as a summary of the fee changes, the Board of Supervisors budget policy, as was just discussed, number 21, cost recovery through fees, directs departments to recover costs where reasonable and after all cost-saving options have been explored. Approximately 77% of our fees are set at full cost recovery. That would be 99% or above. Those that are not at full cost recovery are either that way because of state statute or board policy, such as library fees to encourage the return of library materials. Certain health agency fees are set lower in the interest of public health and safety as well. The majority of our fees, 75%, are unchanged. Slightly over 1% are being eliminated. 19% are increasing, and 4% of the fees are decreasing. So the financial impact of what is being proposed here, overall, we're projecting a net increase of $1.5 million. That is just over a quarter of a percent from the budgeted 14-15 amounts. The main driver in this increase is the expected increase of $1.2 million in behavioral health fee revenue due to the projected increase in reimbursement of mental health services covered by Medi-Cal as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Environmental health is projecting an increase of $151,000. They are incrementally increasing their fees each year, trying to move towards the board policy of full cost recovery. With these proposed changes to their fee schedule, 60% of environmental health fees will be at full cost recovery. Airports is projecting an increase of $130,000 due to increased enplanements and the resulting increase in parking and terminal rent revenue. Notable decreases, information technology is estimating a decrease in revenue of $140,000. This is an 8% decrease due to a reduction in radio communication services, network connection, and desktop consulting fees. The effective date of the fee changes. The first of the calendar year for Schedule A fees, this was set by board direction in 1999. This date has made it easier for parks and golf courses to administer their annual pass fees. Additionally, in fiscal year 12-13, probation fees, and in fiscal year 13-14, selected clerk recorder fees were also added to Schedule A to become effective January 1st, 2015. As a result of these fees being governed by state statutes, that are revised to become effective at the start of every calendar year. All other fees not included on Schedule A are included on Schedule B. Those become effective July 1st, 2015 at the start of the fiscal year. The recommendation, it is recommended that the board adopt the ordinance implementing county fee schedule for calendar year 2015 for all Schedule A fees and fee schedule B effective July 1st, 2015 for all Schedule B fees. Master fee schedule will be produced that contains all fees charged by the county departments. Schedule A will be available January 2015. Schedule B will be available July 2015. Department fee schedules are posted on the county's website. I'm available for any questions that you might have.
Very good, Mr. Cohn. Thank you. Supervisor Ray.
Can you go back to the one that shows the net increase? Can you explain
that how you arrived at that number, is that assuming that all fees that are collected in this last fiscal year are applied at the new rate, or how did you arrive at that total number?
So that's the increase of proposed revenue from the budgeted 14-15 amounts. All the departments submit not only the proposed cost the proposed cost of the fees, but they also submit the proposed units of service sold. So each department calculates how many
new estimates yet. We have experienced an increase in demand for both mental health and substance use disorder treatment services, and more folks are now enrolled in Medi-Cal than were historically. So we saw a big increase in revenue from 13-14 to the current fiscal year, something on the order of $1 million. Why there would be that significant a delta change from this year to next year, I'm not really sure. We will expect to see continued growth in demand for services, and these are services to which people are entitled, both mental health and drug and alcohol services treatment.
Jeff, who is paying this fee? Who are the
Medi-Cal, Okay. Basically. So think of this as charges on your hospital bill.
I don't want to think about that.
Where we are the provider of services, which is, again, principally mental health and drug and alcohol treatment, we maximize our federal financial participation in the reimbursement rate by making sure that we are charging what the service costs. And ultimately, we're audited, and then they reconcile to charges or costs, whichever is lower. So we want to propose to charge what it costs, even though to maximize the federal financial participation, we're obligated to essentially come up with the state share in these programs out of realignment dollars. Folks who are not Medi-Cal, unsponsored individuals, we would use an ability to pay determination to make sure that the charges, which are significant, don't establish a barrier to treatment services.
And at what point do you think you'll have a better idea of how this was established in terms of the dollar? during the budget hearings, or?
Well, yeah, our budget's due basically February 1st or the last week in January, and by then I will have expected our fiscal staff to drill down as close to what we can predict as possible for 15-16.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Another question I had, I guess, or just a comment relative to the fee increase. So we look at the total number of fees that are being increased, and a significant number of them, 135 of those, come out of environmental health. And I was just curious to know why so many of those in that particular area.
Mr. Batson is here to deal with any specific questions that you have, but I thought I'd start by saying, generally speaking, because of the policy that exists that's been referenced this morning in your discussion so far, we attempt to very gradually increase most of environmental health programs are not at 100% cost recovery. So overall, I think we're between 60 and 70% cost recovery. There are many, many different programs and lots of individual fees for all of the things that Kurt's division does. In the interest of reducing the amount of general fund subsidy that would result to those programs that are not 100% fee revenue offset, we propose typically every year, I don't want to call them small, but something in the order of inflation or something like that, because we are not yet at full cost recovery. So,
well, I think you hit on the point that I was wanting to get to, and the fact that if we don't make incremental increases to these, the subsidy that has to come out of the general fund remains or could be larger.
That's correct. And particularly for the last 7 years, as we've been through the recession that we've been through, with the focus on reducing overmatch in the health agency, there's a lot of pressure on the demand for general fund subsidy in agency programs throughout.
Right.
And so in environmental health, we try to minimize that subsidy requirement by continuing to recommend incremental increases in the fees.
If it has to be subsidized by the general fund, then that takes away from our opportunity to do other things
infrastructure, things of that sort, too.
Well, the first cut is health agency programs where the pressure is on to reduce general fund support. But, yeah, beyond the health agency, that's correct.
Before we go to Mr. Batson, if we might, Mr. Hammond, our staff report, you know, there's a I'm looking at page 15 of 25 within the more detailed memo there, and it talks about especially mental health fees and drug and alcohol treatment fees. And what it says at the bottom is that for mental health services, the health agency projects an increase in revenue of approximately $1.2 million, which is 3%. So is the amount of that simply the multiplier, the base level, that you're operating a program that already pulls in significant amounts of revenue from the state on Medi-Cal issues?
That's part of it. We also continue to work with social services to enroll folks in Medi-Cal who weren't historically.
Right. Right.
And so there's probably some incremental effect of that assumption as well.
Very good. Thank you. I don't know, Mr. Meacham or others, do they have questions of Mr. Batson?
Hands of staff report.
The big book of fees.
But in this attachment of Schedule B, it's page 67, 209. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it talks about collection of solid waste, curbside recycling, all those kinds of things. And I see that we have a little increase to that. I'm just wondering, is that the system we use when our waste haulers come in and ask for increases to the customer, and then we are spending more in our contracts, and this is the way we recover? Is that how that works, Dan? I'm wondering how. If this will affect the customers further than when we're at IWMA and we are voting to allow for increases for curbside pickup, is this another increase to the customer?
I'm going to defer to Mr. Batson on this one initially. I'm still trying to flip through my iPad to get to the page here.
It's page 67.
That's all right. I think I just found it, but
okay,
I think he is.
I'm using the paper version.
Okay, good.
Found it right away.
Is my question clear? I'm sorry. Yes. It seems like I'm confusing you, but I'm curious.
My name's Kurt Batson. I'm the Director of Environmental Health. Supervisor Gibson, Supervisor Arnold, the fees that you're specifically referring to, county code requires us to inspect each hauler, solid waste truck, roll-off box, all of the liquid waste haulers, and these are the fees associated with that. They have nothing to do with the franchise agreements that you were referring to that we go through to approve various companies to be, you know, franchised to do that
business.
That's right,
yeah.
So this is not related.
So it's safe to say, though, we're increasing our cost. We're increasing our charges to the contract
to the haulers.
To the haulers. And then if and when they decide to transfer that cost on to the customer, that happens at our IWMA meetings when we approve them to increase their prices.
Yeah, actually, the auditor controller's office here at the county oversees the franchise with the garbage haulers. So they do a thorough rate review with the various companies and then bring that to your board for consideration. And this would be one of many, many factors that could be taken into consideration as part of that review.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Supervisor Arnold. With that, I'll open it to the public. I have one request to speak. Mr. Brown.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. The fees are organized by department, and of course the ones that concern our members and affiliates and so forth are the Ag Commissioner, Fire, the Environmental Protection Division of Public Health, Planning and Building, Public Works primarily. And we were glad to see that in most of those cases there weren't so many fee increases. In fact, I think planning and building only had one, which is good for now. But we think that you ought to have an independent ad hoc commission consisting or committee to study these fees this year. I saw from the slides that maybe staff was going to do some comprehensive look. But we think, you know, some citizen committee with people with experience in workflow, cost accounting, and so forth, to spend some time with the departments and staff. to look at these. And you can look at a lot of questions here. There are 2,088 fees, according to the write-up. But take one like the annual permit renewal for bars that serve no food, which is on page 763 of Schedule B, and it's $408. So what exactly, in terms of time and analysis out there, at what rate does it take $408 to re-review a small bar with no food every year, that you see every year? Or similarly, when there's an application for a development at the pre-app conference at planning, all the departments that are affected come in to sort of give a preliminary, and the fee for environmental health to come to that meeting is going to be $613. So what costs $613? How many hours of work, at what rate is that? Or, and you might say, well, they have to prepare. But for reviewing the parcel maps for water and sewage, they charge a separate $1,485. So it wasn't the analysis for the pre-meeting. So there are...
You know, it's worth pointing out that most of these fees are user fees, and, you know, they aren't affecting everyone. They are affecting people who are using them, and otherwise, as was pointed out, I think, by Mr. Meacham, you know, there's a certain amount of subsidy that goes into it if we don't try to capture the actual amount of money it costs to do these services through the fees. So, you know, I think... by and large, the departments have done a good job of keeping these low, and I do think, to get to Mr. Brown's point, that whenever certain fees are challenged, staff is able to actually explain how those fees were derived at.
I concur. Supervisor Arnold.
Yes, and I'm not ready to accept all of these fee increases, particularly Fund 16002, the one that a lot of us had questions on, that was the environmental health arena. And I think it's just a question, you know, no question that our constituents wish for us to hold down the fees as much as we can. And then comes the question to what services is it up to the county to provide that I think constituents expect it to be. They pay their taxes in various forms, and that's just a service that they can expect through their normal process of paying property taxes, income taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And some of the things I just don't see that in the outside world and private sector business that all of our businesses have fully recovered. So when we're looking at the good job that county government's done and our ability to give some increases to wages and to expand our programs a little bit, I don't think that's happening so much in the small business arena. It was brought up, I think Mr. Brown brought up some of the smaller businesses, but I noticed some of that too, that a small retail market, for example, on page 66, if anyone's following this on the schedule, but a $78 increase to a little bitty seating capacity bar or restaurant of 11 to 15 people, and it's not just that, it's incrementally chipping away, keeps increasing. It would sure be nice to recognize that and say, you know, for a year we're just going to hold fees in some of these areas. In this same section, public pools and spas, a big part of our tourist industry with our hotels, a lot of small hotels, and increasing those fees, is it time to do that? Underground storage tanks at 10%. Those are gas stations. So you raise your inspection fee up to $1,700, I think, for each underground tank at each gas pump. Those are the kind of things I wish we could take a look at and ask, do we have to do that right now? And what is going to be the effect? And lastly, our county fire fees, which is Fund 140, I think, back up at the top here. we know that the county is got a total impact increase due to labor costs through our contracts with CAL FIRE of $764,000. And in our slides, previous slides, County Fire will attempt to absorb this impact, yet we're seeing some pretty hefty 25% kind of across the board to our county fire fees. And that's a question I have again. Do we have to pass that fee on? These are fees that will add to building costs. So while on one hand we spend a lot of time talking about affordable housing, how can we keep that cost down to people that keep the overall building costs down so that we can have affordable housing? We chip away at it, and we continually chip away at it. And so I think my question is just, at what point is there something else that could be done? Can we look at efficiency in these? I know a lot of these costs are for people to go out and inspect things, but can that – that's the one part of this that we don't – I don't think we really assess. Can we do better there and hold these fees down for another year or two until we see more of a recovery in our small businesses and more of a more success in trying to achieve affordable housing?
Mr. Hill?
Yeah, I would answer that a couple of ways, one of which is, as even Mr. Batson noted and Mr. Hamm did, that you know, most of our departments are very sensitive, and particularly over the last 7 years, to the economic difficulties, and therefore haven't, you know, have tried to do so in incremental ways. If we don't do it in incremental ways, then somebody's going to be slapped all of a sudden 1 year with a 300% increase in fees, which is going to make them very angry rather than a small. The other thing is, if you really want to have more money to be able to offset the fees, then you need to support revenue enhancements, which means you need to support tax increases on sales taxes, on transient. Some of the taxes that we only get 24 cents from property taxes. So that doesn't cover, you know, there's a belief sometimes that somehow the property taxes that people pay, which we have no ability to touch one way or another, but that somehow that those in and of themselves pay for everything that occurs at the level of the county government services, and it doesn't. And so that's why you have user fees. And so the only way to change things that I think, again, we've been pretty good. Our department's been very good in not trying to raise fees well beyond it, and we still have, as you see, the report points out, a large number of fees that, you know, will never come close to cost recovery, but we do try to do the best that we can to sort of pay our bills. The only other thing to do is to raise taxes. I mean, that's really the thing that you would have to favor.
Let me go to Supervisor Meacham and then Supervisor Ray.
Yeah, one thing I think we're missing here is that in some of the cases like the environmental health, there are things that are required from the state that have now made them implement certain things that require a cost. And I think that we're missing part of that. And I don't know that we have that specific data to say that this mandate requires this now, but I do know that there are certain instances when the state implements certain things, either from the EPA or whatever the case may be, that filters on down to the local jurisdictions to try to handle that. So I think some of those fees may be relative to that.
Ms. Ray?
Well, I wanted to not get lost in the weeds, for goodness sakes, on this. And if you do the math here, and the health services is $1.2 million, now arguably not quite sure where the number came from, but of $1.5 million, that's 80% of the revenue that's going to be generated here is related to recovery of costs from the state and federal government. And to say, oh, I don't want to raise fees because that hurts families, you're missing the boat here. And if we don't do this, then we absorb that cost. We as taxpayers, we as the county, families absorb that cost. And that this is intended to make that not happen. And to say I don't like fees, it misses the whole point of what we're doing here, which is to make sure that families are protected and that our taxpayers are protected.
I think Supervisor Ray is spot on. We never like to come here and say we're going to be raising fees, but in the overall scheme of things, if you look at the increase, the overall increase proposed, it's extremely modest in my view. We have undertaken extraordinary efforts in improving the efficiency of county government over over recent years, and that has lent itself to the to the fact that we have been able to keep fee increases very, very low. To do less in full cost recovery is providing a subsidy, and if we're going to drill down on over 2,000 fees, look at them individually, I think that's not a good use of this board's time. If we were to examine our fee structure, we should do so in the framework of some kind of policy framework that indicates why we would be doing that. And so, I think overall we can trust that staff has taken a very careful look at these. We are in the business of providing services, and these modest increases seem to me to be clearly necessary. So, Supervisor Arnold, do you want to wrap up here?
I sure do. Thank you. I just had a quick comment, and I don't want to be misunderstood, because I know our county departments are doing what they can, too, and it's the policy that's creating their effort to try to do this full cost recovery. We've talked about it throughout the year that we've had unexpected revenues to the general fund, and I think this is just a philosophical difference maybe between or amongst us, that I don't believe that raising taxes and fees is the way that the fastest way to enhance our revenue. I believe that maybe using more of our general fund as an investment in the economic situation, private sector economy, by holding fees, letting our private sector businesses get a foothold, we create and generate more economic activity, which then brings in possibly more revenue than we would by raising the fees and costing our businesses more in the first place. When I'm talking about the underground tanks and every family paying more money at the tank, that's money that doesn't get spent at the restaurants and the stores, and how we can. So my goal, whether it's right or wrong or you agree with me or not, is to generate more funds to the county to be spent on all these things. It's just a matter of how we go about doing that.
Mr. Beecham.
Thank you. And I'll just wrap this up real quickly in terms of how this relates to other things. The Regional Transit Authority, we just went through a lengthy discussion about the subsidy that Fixed Route pays for ride-on. And so how do we balance that out? We had to balance that out by increasing the fee or the fare for that. So I think that kind of
Black, Mr. Cooper, how are you?
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. I'm Sean Cooper with the County Department of Parks and Recreation. And this morning, I would like to give you a brief presentation on the recommendation to designate $1 million of Parks Public Facility fees for the Bob Jones Pathway Trailhead at the Octagon Barn site. To give you a little bit of background, the county has been working in partnership with the Land Conservancy for many years for the joint goal of establishing the Bob Jones Pathway between the city of San Luis Obispo and Avila Beach. Currently, we have an approximate 2.5-mile segment of the Bob Jones Pathway from the Ontario Road staging area down to Avila Beach. The man, Bob Jones, was the president of the Land Conservancy. His mission was to preserve San Luis Obispo Creek, and this Bob Jones Pathway was one of his visions for the community of San Luis Obispo. The Octagon Barn Center is a property that the Land Conservancy has acquired through lease agreements and have restored the Octagon Barn as a historic landmark and have prepared a site plan and obtained a conditional use permit for site improvements to that site to be a community center and education center, and have worked with county parks on developing that site as a joint use for the staging area at the north end of the county's Bob Jones Pathway. In June of this year, we came to this board to approve the joint operating agreement between county parks and the Land Conservancy. And in this agreement, it outlined site improvements that would be the responsibility of the county, along with maintenance responsibilities that would be the responsibility of the Land Conservancy in perpetuity. Some of those improvements that the county committed to were grading of the site and providing parking lot improvements. To give you an orientation to the site and the Bob Jones Pathway, this is the north end of the photo. Here is the city limits of San Luis Obispo. The gold line here is Highway 101. The green dot here is the Octagon Barn Center. and the pink line is the future 4.5-mile Bob Jones pathway that will connect down to the Ontario Road staging area, which is shown here in blue. The existing Bob Jones pathway is shown here in orange, and it runs all the way down to Avila Beach. This is a more detailed view of the Octagon Barn site. South Higuera runs along this side of the site. This is the actual Octagon Barn. And then the site grading improvements include the whole beige area here, which is the area controlled by the Land Conservancy. Parking lot improvements will be located at the northeast portion of the site behind the barn, and then rough grading will take place at this time as part of this project, as it's unknown what the exact elevation of Buckley Road will end up at, so this end of the site will be left rough graded until improvements are known along Buckley Road. This is the funding table that was in your staff report. I'd like to go through the numbers here, but I'd like to start at the bottom down here at the actual Bob Jones pathway, the large project, which was estimated to be $10.5 million. This would be for the actual trail construction, the 4.5-mile trail construction. This is a budget estimate that was done as in conjunction with the preliminary design. And in that fund, it's the WBS project for the Bob Jones, we have an existing approximately $2.4 million sitting in that project. Of those funds, approximately $1.5 is PFF funding. Now I'm going to jump back up to the access improvements here. The access improvements include the left turn lane. We obtained a transportation grant for $461,000 to do the left-hand turn lane improvements and have also matched that funding with $100,000 in PFF and $5,000 from Land Conservancy. This funding can only be used for the left-hand turn lane. The estimated cost here is a budget estimate that Architectural Services provided. We think it's a conservative estimate, but we want to make sure we have enough funding in this project to cover any potential costs. And now we jump down to here, the project that is for your consideration, the $1 million in new PFF to move into the project, cover the estimated cost of $1.8 million. Again, an Architectural Services estimate that was provided. We think it's conservative. But if you add up the $1 million from today, $667,000 allocated to the left turn lane, and the $1.5 million, we get roughly a little over $3 million, which will be enough to cover both of these components, the left turn lane and the staging area improvements at this time. We wanted to have enough funding in there to cover these two components. We're under conditions of approval for the conditional use permit at the Octagon Barn site, completing the plans and specs, going out to bid, and then construction. We are hoping for construction in summer of 2015 for the left turn lane and parking lot improvements. With that, I will reiterate the recommendation to designate $1 million of Parks Public Facility fees for improvements to the Bob Jones Pathway trailhead at the Octagon Barn site, which includes grading, parking lot improvements, and design and construction. So with that, I will open it up to any questions you may have.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. I do think we have one from Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. A lot of money makes me a little nervous. And I guess I'd asked this question yesterday, and I don't mean to be territorial, but I want to make sure that by reducing this PFF does not affect any of the other projects in the county at this particular point.
We have sought grant funding and match with PFF funding in other areas of the county. San Miguel Park is a good example where we used $500,000 in park public facility fees to match for a land and water conservation fund grant for $1 million project to expand San Miguel Park. In a lot of grant funds, we do use the smaller amounts of the park facility fees to leverage larger funds. So we've been using PFF in different amounts all over the county to complete these projects. Another example of a large capital project that we've taken on with no public facility fees is the Cayucas Pier, where we've gotten $1.5 million in grant funds and then leveraged with community funds and other park funds. So regardless of the funding source, we try to match up the project with funds that are available and allowed to be used for the types of projects that we seek.
I just want to make sure that we're spreading this happiness around.
Yes.
Let me just add the happiness comment there, if I could just briefly. You know, we do track where PFF fees are collected from, and the theory is to try to spend those in rough proportion to where they're collected. Now, in practice, that does vary from time to time from the theory, but that is the approach that we do try to take, is to have proportional representation there.
We understand that. I think Supervisor Meacham's question is a reasonable one. I think one of the ways, though, to look at this project is it has regional significance. This is, even as it is right now, a assembly hall that is getting a lot of use. It has the potential to be the anchor of a world-class recreational amenity, and so I look at it in a little different light because of that aspect. Ms. Arnold?
I agree. This project's been in the works for many years with a lot of volunteer hours and a lot of it will be a regional world-class recreational area. But just for the people that listen to our meetings and might be interested, just to reiterate, the public park or park public facility fees come from residential development, and we've seen a decline over probably the monies coming into that pot over the last few years, but are we starting to see an increase now, a little bump up coming back, a recovery of that fund?
Yes, Supervisor Arnold, those funds are generated through new development. So as the economy slowed down and less development was happening throughout our county, we were collecting less of those public facility fees. We have seen an increase in the last year of development increasing and have hence collected more public facility fees in the last year. So as development increases, we will start collecting more of those funds.
And Sean, do you mind, just for the people that might be interested in follow up on Supervisor Meacham's question, the difference between the Quimby funds and the public parks facility funds? I know we've been using the park facility fees more regionally, but there is another opportunity through Quimby fees to do it more neighborhood.
Certainly. Public facility fees are collected countywide, and they can be used countywide. They are for new growth. They're to serve the new population that is served by the new development, and they can be used for improvement projects and new recreational facilities. The Quimby fees are collected per planning area, so they have to be used in their specific planning areas, and they are used more for the more neighborhood components of the recreation needs throughout the county.
Thank you.
Very good.
If I could just
yes.
I'll defer to him. In regard to the last comment that Supervisor Arnold made with the Quimby fees, can the Quimby fees be coupled together with PFF for projects?
Yes. We've done that in a case with Jack Reddy Park. We used the Quimby fees.
Ms. Kyla Detman of the Land Conservancy.
Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. I am Jessica Berry. I'm with the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. We are a regional transportation planning and funding agency that covers the county as well as all of the incorporated cities. I'd like to start by commending your staff. They have done an excellent job over the years of working on this project collaboratively. Both your park staff as well as your planning staff and the Land Conservancy and a handful of community members have met regularly to try to bring this project together. From SLOCOG's perspective, the Octagon Barn is the staging area for the Bob Jones. It does have a regional transportation significance, which is why we also have funding on the left turn lane into the Octagon Barn staging area. We've seen over the years the funds that we've had on the, most recently the funds that we had on the northern segment of the Bob Jones Trail did lapse and have been reduced. We are optimistic that the new active transportation program, that as the county moves forward and is ready to pursue funds for the transportation facility that is the Bob Jones, that will be successful in securing more of those funds. So mostly I'm just here to commend your staff and to overall support the project and to reiterate that SLOCOG is a partner in this effort.
Very good. Thanks. Thank you, Ms. Berry. Ms. Detman, followed by Leah Brooks.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. Nice to see you guys today. I'm excited to be here. I mean, this is a culmination, really. The fact that we're talking about moving to construction on the staging area is very exciting. And, you know, Land Conservancy, as the staff pointed out, has been an important partner. And I would also like to thank the staff, your staff, for their role in moving this project forward over the years. I thought it would be worthwhile just pointing out some of the investment to date that's outside of the county parks funds that the Land Conservancy and our partners have put into this project. To date, we're over $1.2 million just in the restoration of the Octagon Barn, as well as all the planning that that Mr. Cooper pointed out has happened already. And we also have secured over a mile and a half of the San Luis Obispo Creek corridor along Highway 101 in part, and that's been over a couple million dollars in investment, in part to facilitate the creation of the trail. So we've played a very important role, and there's been a lot of other funds that are already leveraging the dollars you might consider allocating today. So there's a lot of community members, a lot of different agencies that are invested in this. Timeliness is very important. We received a grant from the Natural Resources Agency at the state to do the landscaping, the follow-up work to the parking area, and that those funds do have a clock on them. So if they were to, if this were to get delayed and not funded, we would lose that grant as well. So just an important side note that there are other additional monies that are waiting on this. So, but on a much more, I mean, community note, or much more optimistic note, I'm really excited about this project. Our organization's very excited. We have received outstanding support from so many different businesses, the bicycle community, and others to help make this happen. The Octagon Barn is a perfect fit for the staging area. It's a community icon. It honors our agricultural heritage, our dairy farming heritage, and is also well-loved by the community at large. And, of course, we are very excited for it to serve as a community gathering place in addition to the staging area for the Bob Jones Trail, and serve as a hub for those other trail systems that we hope will someday come to the barn. It's a very exciting time. And the other thing I wanted to add, too, is that while it might seem like the trail itself is a little ways off, doing the staging area now will have immediate benefit to the bicycle community. By serving as a staging area for those that we know you always see bicyclists going down Higuera and headed out towards either Pismo or Avila. So it can serve an immediate benefit to the public. And I just urge your support today, and I'll keep it brief. And
excellent. Thank you.
Leave it there. Happy Thanksgiving.
Leah,
thank you.
What about the cows?
The cows?
Where are the cows?
Well, we do actually.
Dairy barn.
I know. We're hoping to actually get a cow out there in the future, a nice little corral, and do some demonstrations. So it has so many benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Devon. Ms. Brooks, followed by Randy Knight.
Good morning, supervisors. I'm Leah Brooks, representing the Friends of the Bob Jones Trail, a partnership of the San Luis Obispo County Bicycle Coalition and the Land Conservancy. Our number one goal is encouraging construction of the trail in a more timely manner. So we're really excited that we're making some really good progress here. You know, a complete city to sea trail will enhance our quality of life, public health, our appreciation of nature and open space, encourage more transportation by bicycle, and increase tourism. We are really, really excited about the amenities being planned for the Octagon Barn Trailhead, and have no doubt that it will become an instant popular destination for area residents and tourists, including
2-5 months ago. So in that way, you know, if the funding fails to come through, this project will stall. And as Kyla mentioned, there's also we have about $100,000 or more of grant money that's at risk of if the project doesn't move forward. This is a big thing for the community. It's been years in the making. It's still got a ways to go, but this is a big step toward moving it forward. So I hope you'll approve the funding and get this underway. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Knight. Mr. Hellenius, followed by Myron Emmerine.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. I'm the president of the Land Conservancy's Board of Trustees. Mm. I think that the main thing I want to say is that our Board of Trustees enthusiastically supports this project. We are all embracing this project. We see this as one of the highest priorities of our organization for this year. And I also want to point out that, as I mentioned when we were here with Pismo Preserve some months ago, that we have North County high on our radar screen for those of you who are concerned that so many projects are happening in the southern half of the county. We've got the 8,000-acre Atiyah Ranch project that we're working on and hope to bring to fruition in the next year or two, and we've also got the Eagle Ranch project in Atascadero. So we're not neglecting those of you in the North County. One other thing that I want to point out, that is that it'll be a great benefit to the public to see actual construction activity taking place to establish the Octagon Barn staging area for the Bob Jones Trail. And two, I think that given all the pressure that Johnson Ranch faces with parking there, this will relieve a lot of that congestion, a lot of that parking that we see alongside of the road that looks to be a little bit dangerous from my perspective. And so there's a lot of good things that can happen out of moving forward on this project this year. Thanks for your enthusiastic support. Thanks to your staff as well.
Thank you, Mr. Hellenius. Mr. Emery, followed by Pete Jenny.
Still good morning. Myron Emery. I live in San Luis Obispo. I'm a long-time bicycle commuter, recreational cyclist, utility cyclist. I do bulk of my shopping by bike. This project is just the first in a long series of projects that are going to come before you. This is part of a countywide bicycle network, not just for the city of San Luis Obispo or anything. We're talking about a set of regional corridors, bicycling corridors, that will alleviate a lot of safety issues and make possible people to get out of their cars and on their bikes and clear up the air and reduce congestion. An example I'll give you, I commuted on the American River Bike Trail, which is 32 miles long, the equivalent of Avila to Cayucas. So we're looking at connecting Avila to Cayucas with the Chorro Valley Trail, connecting North County from Santa Margarita north to the county line through San Miguel with the San Salinas River Trail and the Danza Trail and many other projects. It's important that you recognize that these facilities are not recreational in nature, period. They are transportation corridors, recreational corridors, and commuting corridors. You're going to get more and more people out there on their bikes commuting and getting to work or getting to their friends' houses in their other parts of the county, not just within the cities. In my 43 miles a day commute for 23 years on the American River Bike Trail, people always ask me, aren't you afraid about riding in the dark on the trail? And I go, no, it's nothing compared to being on the city streets or the county roads or the freeway. It wasn't until I came back here to retire that I met that car that I've been trying to avoid for 64 years. Okay, so these projects are a safety issue involved. This is an excellent staff set of work to put this package together, and I hope that you move forward with this and with continuing to link up the different parts of the county. It's not just here right now, but you've got to start someplace. Then the spider legs go out, the spokes of the wheel go out, and you cover the county. And hopefully the cities will follow suit and connect up their parts, and we'll have a long-range bicycle network throughout the county and the cities. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Ameren. And last word to you, Mr. Jenny.
Morning, Peter Jenny. I am a member of the Board of Trustees for the Land Conservancy. I have a couple of things I want to point out, one of which I'm still thrilled to see that parks and recreation issues are so vitally important to this community by the massive turnout we have this morning. This relationship between the Conservancy and the county has gone on for close to 20 years. It's been a collaboration that has paid benefits not only to both entities, but to the community at large, which is really the reason for doing this. I'd like to just point out a couple of factors that have been a little bit overlooked, where that benefit really is hitting the road here. With this project, what we're essentially doing is saving the county going out and having to find another location to provide the much-needed staging area. And think about that. I mean, untold hundreds of thousands of dollars. The theory behind having a regional system for the use of public facility fees, because we do move around when we're using these fees. So it really does benefit everybody. The tourists who will come to use this trail are going to go to the wine country. They're going to spend their dollars throughout this county. So there really is something for everybody I know you folks know that. I want the people listening at home to hear that as well. This is really a kind of a no-brainer. That's why this project has been proposed for so many years, and I urge you to support supplementing the funding necessary to make it happen. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jenny, and thank you all who came to speak in support. That was our last request to speak, and I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board and the supervisor of the district, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's certainly a great pleasure to hopefully see this moving forward. And there's, as is mentioned, I won't reiterate, but there's been so many great partners in helping us to get where we are, and the Octagon Barn is really one of the the restoration of it has just been so wonderful, he's not here, but B.K. Richard has been a critical part in overseeing and continuing to spread the community love for the Octagon Barn, which is a really unique icon in our community. The Bob Jones Bike Trail is something, you know, it's one of those things that we get every now and then as supervisors to continue a legacy started by predecessors, and this was something that began under Supervisor Delaney and continued under Supervisor Pinard, continued under Supervisor Lenthal, and I'm pleased to be able to see this move forward under my own time here. I think everybody's explained the benefits, and I can certainly say that when it comes to parks and trails, I'm going to support them everywhere in our community, whether it's North County, South County, either side of the coast, because they have it's become increasingly obvious that they are such an essential part of our community, both for residents and visitors, that we're sort of against the clock to come up with more funding to keep up with the demand, which is a good problem to have. I think it's and hearing Myron speak about the ability to access a community-wide bicycle network is it just warms the heart. So I move the staff recommendation forward.
Second. Thank you, Mr. Hill, and thank you, Ms. Ray. I enthusiastically support this motion. It's been my pleasure to work for most of the 20 years with the Land Conservancy in one capacity or another, and to see where that facility has come from and the promise it holds for our county as a whole is truly heartwarming. With no further discussion, I would ask Madam Clerk for a roll call vote.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you to my colleagues.
Go forth and move dirt. So we'll look forward to the results. Madam Clerk, we have one more item before we break for lunch. Would you introduce that to us, please?
Item number 36, a hearing continued from June 17, 2014, to consider a resolution setting forth the determination of established vested rights at the Whale Rock Pit, Cayucas Pit, California Mine ID 91-40-0010, located at 1424 Old Creek Road, east of the community of Cayucas, including the scope and nature of surface mining activities included within the established vested rights. It is recommended that the hearing be continued to Tuesday, February 10th, 2015, District 2.
Mr. McMaster.
It's still morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Steve McMaster's Planning Department. As was noted, this is a request for continuance. This item originally came in June. At the end of that hearing, there was it was the best route was determined to be a continuance in order to for the county to work with the operator on some details regarding the vested mine determination. A lot of progress has been made. There are still some details, so we hope that one more continuance will get us to the point where we will come back in February with most of the issues resolved for the board.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. McMaster. Any questions? So, Mr. McMaster, seeing none, I'll open it to the public. With no request to speak, seeing no one coming forward, I'll bring it back to the board and move continuance to February 10th of 2015.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. And opposed, none. Thusly done. That brings us to closed session. I have no request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public and ask counsel for an estimate.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council, about 25 minutes.
Yeah, that sounds manageable. We thank you. We will reconvene at 1:30. Welcome back to the afternoon session. Council,
yes.
What happened in closed session today?
It's my pleasure. I didn't know this. Whereas
none of that's made up either, is it?
Rob Roy Reed. Pretty cool. Has worked for the County of San Luis Obispo without interruption since August 6, 1984, encompassing 30 years of employment. And whereas Rob Roy Reed started out as a public safety dispatcher and was promoted to deputy sheriff in December of 1985 to senior deputy July 1988, sergeant December 1990, lieutenant February 1999. What did you do to do all this? Get all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And commander in July of 2004, and then promoted to chief deputy in November 2005, where he currently oversees support services. And whereas Rob Roy Reed is described as a dedicated and hardworking member of the Sheriff's Office executive team who utilizes his expertise to ensure our larger complex projects are completed properly. He is extremely capable and can be depended on to assist wherever needed. And Rob is an outstanding representative of the Sheriff's Office to the communities we serve and has received numerous letters of appreciation during his years of service, recognizing him for his outreach to the communities and high levels of service. And whereas Rob Roy Reed, in addition to the supervisorial positions already listed, has held numerous critical positions in the Sheriff's Office, including Rangemaster, Public Information Officer, Search and Rescue Liaison, Property Officer, Custody Sergeant, which have all helped to mold the Sheriff's Office into a strong team that it is today. Therefore, be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors, County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, that Rob Roy Reed be and hereby commended for his 30 years of dedication to the county mission, and that Rob is wished the best of health, happiness, good fortune in his continued service and beyond.
Is Sheriff Parkinson going to try to offer?
Wow. Thank you.
Go ahead. Give it your best shot.
Well, good afternoon. And I want to start with just saying thank you. Thank you to Rob for allowing us to postpone this. Thank you to HR for doing this. And thank you to the board. We had to postpone it a couple weeks ago when others got their award because we were attending a funeral for a Ventura County Sheriff's deputy at that time, so we had to leave. So it was nice to be able to do this. This is a very important thing to be able to recognize somebody for 30 years, and not just 30 years in law enforcement, 30 years with one agency. So it made me think back 30 years. What exactly happened 30 years ago? So here, I'll tell you a few things that happened 30 years ago. So 30 years ago, the Breakfast Club was meeting for detention. Remember that movie? Ghostbusters was first released. I wish I could say the movie Rob Roy was released, just for your amusement. Doug Flutie, of course, with then Boston College, completed the Hail Mary. Taping, believe it or not, was just legalized for television. And that was the old VHS tape. You could legally tape. The first female Boeing 747 pilot. Space Shuttle Discovery's first launch. The first Macintosh computer was created. And then finally, I had to include this, Michael Jordan signed his first rookie contract 30 years ago. Now, of course, at that time, there was no cell phones in law enforcement, way pre-cell phone, way pre-computers for law enforcement. So it's been a long road for 30 years. And Rob obviously has experienced it all. And some of the things that Supervisor Meacham read, I just want to highlight a few of them. That Rob starting as a dispatcher was interesting because now, of course, our dispatch is all computer driven. So everything that comes in is entered in the computer. Back in those days, most of it was done by cards, by a stamp on a time stamp on a machine. So everything was handwritten. So it was a really a different period of time for law enforcement. And Rob over his 30 years has got to see an evolution, you know, as a dispatcher and as a deputy sheriff. Of course, Rob became a deputy sheriff and then promoted through the ranks. And I really want to spend just a minute talking about what Rob does now and why it's so important to the sheriff's office. Rob is of course, our administrative chief deputy. And for me, Rob is kind of my right-hand man for everything that we need to get done project-wise. Rob knows more about construction than probably I care to know about construction. And he gives me annual lessons when we or daily lessons when we walk out to look at the progress of the jail. The jail that you're quite aware of is quite a project. It's Rob that really started that project from the beginning. Rob that's seeing it through, and the nice thing is Rob will be able to see that project through to its completion before he decides he's gonna hang up his boots. Also, Rob has been involved in many other projects, the property room that we relocated, and then the establishment of our first coroner's office in this county that was built almost 2 years ago, I think now. So I really wanted to be here, and I'm glad we were able to put it off just so I could tell Rob, on behalf of the citizens of the County of San Luis Obispo, on behalf of the men and women of the Sheriff's Office, thank you for all you've done for the Sheriff's Office. Thank you that you've done for the community, and we still have a few more years left in you, so don't stop now.
Just
a few.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you.
My turn? Just about.
You look around here, and I had no idea how many people were going to show up. I thought it'd be one or two. But it's a little bit more than that. And I couldn't do what I have done without the support of all these people. And whether it be in my department, general services, planning department, county roads, I mean, just, you know, it goes the whole breadth of the county departments. I've really enjoyed working with them over the years. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you, Rob. All right. Supervisor Hill is going to read our second resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kat Lauterbach from Department of Social Services.
Yeah. And
it's a pleasure for me to read this resolution proclaiming November as Family Caregivers Month, Appreciation Month. And, of course, you know, these are people who have who do the real hard work, and increasingly so in our community and every community, with an aging population and a greater need for people to be able to stay in their homes and get services. So this is a real pleasure for me. Whereas Family Caregivers and In-Home Support Services, IHSS, home care workers, provide high-quality, compassionate care and much-needed support for individuals and families who are in need of assistance for caring for ill, elderly, or disabled family members. And whereas across the nation, the month of November is recognized as National Family Caregivers Month, while in the state of California, that week of November 9th through 15th is recognized as IHSS, Home Care Worker Recognition Week, in the effort to honor the contributions of IHSS caregivers who give their time, patience, care, and support to their families and the entire community. And whereas in San Luis Obispo County, over 1,500 IHSS caregivers provide home care services and support which make it possible for low-income disabled and elderly residents in San Luis Obispo County to remain living independently in their homes. Whereas in-home caregivers provide services to assist low-income, elderly, blind, and disabled people, that includes bathing and dressing, bowel and bladder care, feeding and meal preparation, and household chores. In addition to the improved quality of life for the elderly or disabled individual, the cost of in-home care is about 50% less than the cost of nursing care. So now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors is hereby proclaimed November as National Family Caregivers Appreciation Month and the week of November 9th through 15th as IHSS Home Care Workers Recognition Week in San Luis Obispo County. And in so doing, we urge all citizens to join in a national effort to raise awareness about the importance of in-home support services. Want to come up and get this?
Congratulations. And okay. If you'd like the photo op,
yeah, you can do a quick
photo op.
Thank you.
All,
thank you.
Dory has a cat.
Do you want to do a quick photo here with the...
No, I guess not.
You don't have to.
It's all part of the package.
Yeah, we have a package deal.
It's a package deal. They want Rita and Dan. That's fine. I get it. That's good.
I'm a little bit.
Yeah. She's very sensitive. I understand. I understand completely. Thanks. Thank you, Derek. Yeah. And Ms. Lauterbach, you're welcome to the lectern for any comments. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing these folks do, and in particular, the IHSS workers do a lot for folks.
Thank you, and thank you for this recognition on behalf of all of the caregivers. We have two caregivers from the union who work in the IHSS program and take care of others. And family members and make their lives better. This program is a win-win for all. It makes people's lives better, and it is cost-effective. So it allows people to live their lives safely and with dignity. What more could we ask? Thank you.
We thank you, and we thank them. Mr. Parkinson, follow on that.
Mr. Gibson, we failed to get a picture of Chief Reed with the board.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I knew you'd want one. Yeah.
It's part of the package.
So, yeah, it's part of the package. The 8x10s will be available in the lobby, and wallet size, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Isn't
Rob Roy a drink?
Good one.
Can we get one more picture with everybody from the sheriff's office?
Yeah,
come
on up.
Very good.
Take all that
picture. We got all the time in the world.
Why do we say no? You guys have guns.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Armed and unarmed.
Yes, right. Yeah.
It's okay.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Clerk, we need to get down to business now. Could you introduce our next item?
Item number 40: request for authorization to process a specific plan, general plan, and land use ordinance amendment LRP 2014-00001, Monarch Dunes Joint Venture LLC. To amend provisions of the Woodland Specific Plan that would replace the Phase 2A and Phase 2B golf course with crop production and other amenities, reduce the maximum size of resort development, expand the list of allowable uses within the business park, relocate a portion of the retail development, redistribute residential units, rename the village Monarch Dunes, and consider potential increase in the number of the allowable dwelling units. The site is in the Woodlands Village in the South County Inland Subarea of the South County Planning Area, District 4.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Mr. Bergman, welcome this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Gibson, board members. This is the first step to modify the Woodlands Specific Plan, and it starts with a request of authorization by your board. And we have Jay Johnson and Trevor Keith down below who will give you all the details as you get started on this item.
All right. Very good. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Jay Johnson, planning staff. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. The purpose of authorization is for a couple of things. First of all, it's for your board to determine whether to amend a specific plan or not, in this case, rather than, say, the housing element. But we also do that for specific plans. And then the other thing where your board can do and we appreciate is when you provide direction on some of the particular elements in to be analyzed in an amendment such as this. A great many details go into it. On the screen is the vicinity map that shows the Woodland Village, Woodlands Village located on Highway 1, about 2 miles west of the community of Napomo in the South County planning area. The existing specific plan allows for a variety of uses. It was adopted in 1998, It allows for up to 1,320 residences, a mix of commercial retail and commercial service uses, and a village center and a business park that have been mapped and under construction. Up to three golf courses, two of which are built this time. Hotel resort with up to 500 rooms, and then a 10-acre public park and trails and habitat area for butterflies throughout the village. This is our 2011 aerial of the site. The yellow line on the screen separates the phases 1A and 1B to the north from phases 2A, 2B to the south. You can see that most of, I'll try to hold the cursor still a little bit here, but the phase 1A golf course has been built, and most of the homes in phase 1A have also been constructed. As I stated, this is a 2011 aerial, so a lot of the phase 1B off of Camino Caballo, those neighborhoods are also close to being built out. At this time, there's a little more than half of the 1,320 homes have been built on the project. So the proposed amendment would affect the southerly part of the project, where phases 2A, 2B would be located. And again, it's slightly less than half of the village. It doesn't include any of the business park, which is located along Highway 1 here, where we do have one business at this time, and in the village center that is northeast of the butterfly habitat area. On the screen is an illustration. This is prepared by the applicant that shows what is currently planned for in phases 2A, 2B. The distinction here is specific plan plans for these. Entitlements would still be needed to do this, to build a golf course. And it includes about 405 single-family residences, 18-hole golf course, and the resort site. Again, the applicant is proposing changes and shifting of some of these items that I'll get into in a few moments here. As I mentioned, a conditional use permit would be required for each major phase. It could be one conditional use permit to cover both phases and the golf course if they wanted to pursue that. That CUP would have to go through environmental review. It would receive public input from the South County Advisory Council, and then ultimately with public hearings before the County Planning Commission. Right, so that would take adding ag processing as an allowable use. Other to go along with the wine grapes, the applicant is also proposing a variety of smaller recreational facilities that the people in the Woodland Village could enjoy. The other aspect that this is a staff recommended addition to this is to consider potentially increasing residences. That just open that as a possibility to perhaps add to the workforce housing stock in the South County. So that's something staff is requesting to be added to the proposal. As part of a requirement that the framework for planning outlays for staff to do at this point is to identify to your board what we, at the very preliminary level of analysis, to identify what are the major issues with that. And so it's not a great surprise that water resources, that will be number one. For today's discussion, I think it's important to make one distinction about that, in that we haven't done a full analysis on the water, and that would be analyzed through the environmental review. But we have had some preliminary information provided by the applicant that would suggest that their proposal to you have crop production rather than a golf course would indeed, in most scenarios, use less water. And so while that's a favorable matter and part of the policy decision the Planning Commission and your board will ultimately make, comparing this use versus that use in their water on demand, ultimately through environmental review, what the CEQA guidelines and the statute will ask us to do as staff in preparing the environmental document is to compare what's on the ground today and the current environmental situation on the mesa. And we know that's a level of severity 3 for that groundwater basin. So that will be issue number one, but we'll get into that one in the months to come. other environmental issues that will be looked at in what staff is projecting to be an environmental impact report would be traffic, air quality, and visual impacts. There are several other environmental issues that won't need to be revisited from the 1999 environmental impact report. That'd be matters such as biology and archaeology and things that haven't shifted over time. Other elements that we'll be considering as we move through this is the continued provision of affordable housing. Staff feels that exploring additional homes could to add to that. It's important for this to the business park to continue to have the opportunity to build out, have job creating uses there, and also to provide some local shopping opportunities, not only for the people in the immediate village, but that live nearby Woodlands to have the opportunity to shop and conduct business or get a haircut where they may not have to drive into a Roy Brandy, something such as that. Lastly, and most importantly probably today, because we've received a letter from the Ag Commissioner, the Ag Department's office that we'll get into here in a moment, is Ag resources and land use compatibility. Your board received a letter, it's in your packet from the Ag Department, that recommends not authorizing ag production as allowable uses in the village. The Ag Commissioner is here, and they're prepared to answer questions and speak to their concerns about health and safety issues involved with introducing agriculture into a residential neighborhood. Should your board determine to authorize crop production, then the Ag Department recommends that the ag production be isolated in the village and that buffering be considered as well, providing a separation between the uses, and then control the access so that children aren't wandering into the production areas and unauthorized access into the production areas. Your board is probably familiar with maybe not the title of it, Ag Policy 17, but it's the policy that directs the Ag Commissioner to look at buffers for situations when we introduce housing into an agricultural area. And so Appendix C in the agricultural element provides distances as a starting place for the Ag Department to look at when they recommend buffers on projects. This one's different. The suggestion is here to introduce agriculture into a residential neighborhood. So while staff agrees that policy on its face doesn't apply to this application, the notion of buffering, providing a separation between uses that have some compatibility issues, is appropriate. The reasoning behind buffering is appropriate. And if your board authorizes the crop production as an allowable use in the village, then staff will continue to work with the applicant. We'll go through the environmental review process and establish the appropriate buffers through the full vetting of that issue. So agreement, we think it's appropriate to reduce the size of the resort, and to shifting homes around is fine, and to bring multifamily in, instead of isolating in one spot, to spread that out. Those are all great things, and we look forward to working with the applicant on that. The next thing would be, as you work through this, to authorize a revised scope. That would be authorizing crop production with evaluating buffers, authorizing crop production and isolating the crops, authorizing crop production but not additional homes. So I think you get a sense of that. And then lastly, you do have the choice of not authorizing. And staff, as working through framework for planning and our preliminary analysis of this, sees no reason to not authorize something for this to move forward. It's a village we want to see thrive. It's set in the South County. One day Woodlands will actually achieve a amount of homes and activities to where it could be an urban area as the same as Napomo or Templeton, maybe not as large. So the results, if you choose option one or two, we'll continue processing. We'll send out referrals to a multitude of agencies, to the South County Advisory Council, and we'll move forward with an initial study. We're almost certain that will be an environmental impact report requirement. We'll draft the amendments and then take it to public hearing. This could take, with an environmental impact report, could take a year or more to get through. And then third, if you choose third option, then we stop and I go back to my desk and the landowners can pursue a land use entitlements, as I mentioned, under the existing specific plan. But I would reiterate that that will entail a conditional use permit and that will require environmental review. That concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Very good.
To answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We'll start with Supervisor Ray.
All right. I got a couple questions for you. I want to make sure that we are delineating exactly what we're doing today. So you mentioned that it appeared the way you were talking is that we are authorizing that use today, that use being the ag. But it was my understanding that what we're authorizing is walking the path to look at whether we would authorize that use. Can you tell me exactly where that line is?
Sure. Specifically to authorize crop production. By doing so, then we will create a project description that we can send out to the agencies and the advisory council that will head towards an environmental determination, an environmental impact report, that describes crop production, in this case the applicant's desire to grow wine grapes, somewhere on the property. We'll work with the applicant to create maps where that is located. It doesn't have to follow the exact path of where the golf course is, but wine grapes would show up somewhere in the project. You're not authorizing them to go plant grapes. You're authorizing the specific plan to be amended to include that provision. You could authorize the wine grapes crop production to be an allowable use in the Woodlands Village, and then third week in February they could file a CUP to build a golf course. That won't go away, the ability to build a golf course.
Could I just correct that, Mr. Johnson? We could authorize today the consideration of a specific plan amendment that would include crop production as an allowable use.
Correct. So as we work through this.
Precise bit of could or could not, depending right. on the analysis that we go forward.
That's what I thought, but you're saying that we're making that decision right now.
No.
Let me continue to clarify. This is a confusing part of our framework that, having been here since
the framework
Rob
was developed,
Roy was here, that you're basically saying, go ahead, go analyze these things, and one would be crop production. When we work through this, if where the crops are located and the mitigation just doesn't seem right to, say, the Planning Commission first before it comes back to your board, the Planning Commission may recommend that not be included in the actual amendment. But if you don't authorize the crop production as part of this today, then it can't show up in the amendment down the road.
But we're authorizing for the processing of that, not necessarily for its inclusion.
Correct.
Right.
Your board, it will come back to you months later with that in there, and then the board at that time can decide whether to approve it or not.
Okay.
Can I simplify that further? Is a decision to have it stop here at point A or move on to point B for further consideration?
That was my understanding, but it sounded like the decision was being made right now.
Right. It does a little bit, but the way I look at it is we're outlining the limits of the playing field here. For instance, we are not going to authorize them to consider putting an oil refinery on this land, because apparently there's one in Napomo already.
And if you are comfortable with buffering, then it would be probably in the realm of option two. You would say, yes, we as a board we don't have a problem with ag crop production being allowed at Woodlands. Well, we would like you to explore through your process what buffering might.
Well, that's my question. Wouldn't we do that anyway?
Through the CEQA process, we would, yes.
Okay, and then I'm confused because it just came up yesterday in meetings. Isn't ag an allowable use in rec designation, and this is a rec designation? And I'm confused about how. Can you help me untangle that?
Sure, that's a much easier question. Thank you. It's allowed in the rec category, but not in Woodlands Village. We have a countywide, what we call Table 3-2 or 2-3, allowable uses And Woodland's specific plan has its own table of allowable uses.
I see.
It's simply not in there.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I know that timing is an issue for Shea because they have production in line and they don't want any gaps in that production. So my question is, would an expedited processing at their cost be available to them in the same way that we've done for other applicants in the recent past?
Yes, it can be expedited to a certain extent. Because it needs the CUP and we're moving things around in the specific plan area, I can't think of very good reasons to either rely on the 1998 environmental impact report because times have changed, the water situation's changed.
No, I'm not suggesting that they don't do an EIR.
And so because of that EIR, that time frame is the biggest chunk. We can work with the applicant to get to the EIR quickly. We can work with the applicant to get through the EIR process as quickly as possible and then get to the Planning Commission quickly as well.
I understand that you're going to do that, but my question is we have another applicant in District 4 that we have contracted out to help them get to that point faster and not using our staff. And maybe I'll let Trevor talk about it because Trevor knows what I'm talking about here.
The answer is yes.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Trevor. That's it.
Okay, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is also allowing for, if we were allow this to go forward, for the processing of grapes as well. Is that correct?
Correct.
So there's a processing facility that would be built there?
In the business park.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure I'm clear on this. The existing specific plan allows for certain things, but it doesn't permit them until they get a CUP. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That's good for right now.
I do think it's important, Mr. Meacham, to make that distinction between the reasons and the nature of the specific plan or our general plan, which is not an entitlement. And in this particular case, that question of the baseline for the CEQA analysis to me is quite important. And as you know, we are looking at the water source for this. Any development on the Napomo Mesa to be from a basin that we've designated level of severity 3, which means at or beyond its utilized at or beyond its safe yield. So the question of any development going forward, either in a planning fashion or in an entitlement fashion, has to recognize that. And I would just confirm, you speak fairly confidently that any modification of this plan is going to need an EIR. But in that EIR, the baseline against which we analyze the impacts of the project is the current state of the water basin at or beyond its safe yield.
Correct.
Okay. I guess the question there going forward, if this were an unplanned area or a generically planned area and a specific proposal was brought forward, we would be doing an AB 600 study of water use as to the availability of a long-term water source because the number of units proposed here is enough. Would we be doing the equivalent of that to this proposal?
I may need council's input. We did one mm-hmm. in 1998, and I don't know if we'll need to revisit that or not.
Mr. McNulty, the thought?
Yeah, I think we will have to, assuming that the number of units remains as high as what's been proposed.
What it would seem. Again, all part of the robustness. We can talk a little bit. I'm going to let the applicant come and offer us the proposal here in just a second. But I think
the applicant, and they are considering crop production, and then they, once you get into some of your environmental review, never mind that, we're going to go back to what our entitlements were, that kind of thing, it would... Your environmental review would then turn to another direction. So is it possible that we authorize something today allowing you the flexibility to determine, for staff to determine how much environmental review and in what areas, what you've already done that still is apropos today and what you need to make changes to or update?
Good question. Your board doesn't need to make a determination one way. That flexibility is already given to staff as to what level of environmental review to recommend.
So if we just, basically today, if we're looking and we're authorizing other options, you take all that and you figure it all out. And then you, depending on where what direction it goes, you decide what environmental review is necessary.
Correct.
Yeah? Okay.
Mr. Meacham.
I want to get something clear in my head on the water issue. Based upon what you're saying, that it allows for certain things, but a conditional use permit would be required to do anything, they would have to provide, I guess, adequate information relative to water resource. So is there the potential that they could come forward with what currently is allowed and be denied?
Yes, answer to that is yes, there would be a conditional use permit. The Planning Commission could take all the information presented and documented in the environmental determination and elect to deny the CUP for development of the third golf course.
And what about the residential portion of it? Same thing?
The same thing.
Because I guess because of the concern that I have is because it is in a level 3 severity. And I don't know, we're talking about there would be less water used based upon vineyards as opposed to a golf course, but there's nothing being used right now. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we really don't know at this point what's going to be consumed.
And that's correct. That's the baseline we have to deal with under CEQA, and that's the comparison.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham, for those questions. With that, I would offer the applicants or the applicant's agent, I have a slip from Ms. Kirk here, to present. About how long do you think you need?
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman Gibson.
Either way.
We'll probably hopefully not take the full minutes because I think I'll keep my comments brief because I think Jay covered most of the things in his presentation.
Okay.
We just, we're happy to be here today. We understand that this is the first step in what is probably going to be a longer process than any of us hope, but we recognize the reality of going through the environmental review process, and we know that there are issues that are going to need to be addressed. Our main thoughts today on crop production, and Supervisor Ray, you asked some great questions. Why are we asking for crop production? Isn't it normally allowed in other recreation land use categories? And it is. Crop production, which is an important component of the project we want to move forward with, is typically allowed in recreation land use category, and further, under special standards in Title 22, it specifically states that the establishment of crop production within village areas is not restricted. So we think we've got a basis for moving forward with the use. The only reason it's not included as an allowable use within the specific table in the Woodlands specific plan is because it wasn't a part of the project at that time. The specific plan and the allowable uses that were developed as part of the original specific plan reflected what the project was then. And so based on, and I think Preston will run through those changes, there's some reasons why we want to change and look at incorporating additional items. And regarding the buffers, the discussion on the buffers, we appreciate the clarification from staff. We understand that there's a public safety issue that's going to need to be addressed, and we're more than happy to work on that through the CEQA process. We just wanted to get off on the right step, knowing what ag element policies that we're going to be held for consistency with through our review. And whenever we look at the ag policies and the ag element, it's clear that if our land use is recreation and we don't have an established crop, we're not subject to Ag Policy 17. We're subject to Ag Policy 24 as well as Ag Goal 3. So, again, recognizing that we want to make sure that our members are safe and that there is adequate mitigation provided for the interface of those uses. So we will address it, more than happy to address it during the CEQA process. And then regarding didn't expect the discussion to go to the length of the level of severity 3 because we know that we're going to look at the water issue through the process. But whenever you go back to the study that was the water supply in the Napomo Mesa study from 2004, it specifically exempts the Woodlands Village from the level of severity 3 findings. So there's specific.
Largest privately held builder in the country.
Our vision is to be the most respected builder in the country. Not the most profitable, not built the most homes, but the most respected. And our purpose is to enhance people's lives. We talk about it daily. We make decisions all the time in that regard. We're different than most other big public builders, and certainly most other builders in general. John Shea is the chairman of our board. He just turned 88. He goes into the office regularly. His son and grandchildren live here on the Central Coast in Shell Beach, so he visits the community often. His name is on every community we build and on every home that we close with homeowners and members. Legacy is incredibly important to him, and his desire is a legacy of quality, sustainability, and satisfaction. It's one of the reasons why during the downturn we stayed committed to the Central Coast while other builders left. We built the Monarch Club, which many of you have been in. We subsidized it through the downturn. This company is committed to the Central Coast, and it's committed to standing by its legacy and not bailing out on projects. So the Woodlands Village, as you heard the history, was approved in 1998. We've been building homes there since 2005. We're about halfway through, as Jay mentioned. But it's important to recognize that we're a green builder. We were the first to start including solar on our homes nationally. We include enough solar on all of our homes to zero out the electric bill on homes, and so that all of the homes moving forward, imagine a community that has net no pull on the grid. It's pretty incredible. This wasn't dictated by the county. This is something that we do because legacy and sustainability is important to us as a company. We were recognized by one of the previous supervisors of the board as being a green builder. And we give back. So we sponsor the Slow Symphony. We sponsor the Clark Center and many, many other local charities. Of note, we've built three homes over the last few years for St. Jude Children's Hospital, raising over $2.1 million to fight childhood cancer. We truly care, and we try to do that on a local basis here on the Central Coast by showing that we care. So the new plan is really about leaving a sustainable legacy. Sustainable in terms of, we want to make sure that we meet the current environmental state that we live in and the current fiscal world that we live in, which has changed since our approvals in 1998. So we're looking at a trifecta. We want water conservation, economically sustainable, and we want it to be safe. It's critically important to us. So in terms of water conservation, vineyards use on average a third less water than golf courses use. It's significant. Sustainability. Golf is in a decline. I understand you heard this morning that some of the county-owned golf courses are struggling. We have two golf courses that are in. They are not yet profitable. Nationwide, there was a net closing of 146 golf courses. We want to protect our recreation in the Woodlands. And so we want to make sure that we don't oversupply the market by building another golf course. Additionally, we want to bring forward our village center. So part of what Jay's been working with us on is getting the concept of being able to live, work, and play in one village forward. We've had the commercial on the market for 5 years and have had no action on it. We've got one building that's in. It's an office building for of all things, an agricultural marketing company for Santa Maria Valley. So, however, in tying into the local tourism market that drives the Central Coast, which is based on, of course, our wonderful beaches as well as our vineyard and winery business. So by tying into that, we allow our village center to get off the ground. We've already received much interest from retail and commercial operators that say, that's a great concept, and that ties into what brings people to the Central Coast, and that will be successful. We're willing to open a business there. It will help us get our village center off the ground. And finally, this concept's not new. We have a project up in Brentwood called Trilogy Vineyards, where we integrate vineyards into the community, and we have homeowners living next to vineyards. It's absolutely a wonderful community. People love it. We have hundreds of people living there. They love the experience. They love how it works, and frankly, the interaction with ag has been successful. And so we offer that as a basis to consider that this has been a successful alternative to golf courses moving forward. So one of the things that Supervisor Ray mentioned is that it is important to us that we explore an expedited process. We are running out of home sites to be able to build on. We do have over 1,000 current jobs that are going. We don't want those people to go home without a job. So this at the end of this phase two, we'll have over 2,100 long-term jobs. And so there's a big growth in jobs.
Our biggest concern, of course, is that and the 1998 Environmental Impact Report stated that, well, we don't really think there's a problem, but there will be a very big problem if the water basin sinks below sea level, and we therefore have water stop flowing to the ocean, we can have saltwater intrusion. And we now have 70,000 people in the five cities and up on the mesa, and saltwater intrusion is a very real possible problem. We no longer use our wells in the five cities because we can't, because they're at that level where we've had saltwater intrusion before. The water is not flowing to our wells, and it is below sea level on the mesa in some of the depressions. I'm not sure if it's at the Woodlands Depression, but that one certainly bears looking at. I'd also like to ask you to seriously consider whether or not the proposal for a vineyard really saves 30% water. A lot of the water that's being used on the golf courses now is reclaimed, and I think it's important to look at whether that water is cleaned up enough that it could be used on vineyards. Also, they're claiming that the vineyards only need to be watered 6 months out of the year, but I can tell you that whole development needs to be watered almost year-round, except when it's raining, because the dust problem is so high there. And we do know, and I'm going to now go into my own comments on this, we do know that dust is a huge issue out there. And there are a couple of things that help when you're building, but we know that dirt roads create more dust in the county, more particulate in the county, than any other thing. So it's surrounded by dust roads, it's got construction all through it, and now we're proposing vineyards. If you look at the fields of lavender that they've provided in the report, there's not a lot of dirt hanging around those fields of lavender. They're pretty much covering it. They're good ground cover. But vineyards are very dirt intensive. And we're talking about buffers that the Ag Commission says need to be 400 to 800 feet. And I think there will be at 25 feet to the property lines, I think you're going to have terrible dust problems, and you will need to water intensively year-round. So I'm not sure that this argument that vineyards use less water really hangs together. I'll stop there. There's more I'd like to say. Oh, finally, please don't cut down the trees. The APCD tells us, and we know from experiments worldwide, that trees are the buffer between refineries, and they're the buffer between particulate, and they work at freeways. And if you cut down more of those eucalyptus trees, which was not presented today in the staff report here, but it is in the report that you have in your hands, that they want to cut down more of those trees as a buffer, if you cut down those trees, you will cause harm to the people who live on the mesa. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. That was our last request to speak, and seeing no one else coming forward, we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board for deliberation. Ms. Ray.
Well, I just wanted to bring up a couple things, and first of all, I think that the very first thing out of Mr. Johnson's mouth was really important, and this is to the purpose of today's hearing is to provide direction on particular elements of what we're doing going forward. So we're not approving a plan today. We're not approving water use today. We're not even approving how we're going to arrive at the answer to the question today. In other words, what level of CEQA is going to happen. What we're simply doing is calling the question and deciding whether or not there's a fatal flaw here. So as we head into deliberations here, I would like to see us make sure that we stay on track as to what the actual question before us is today and not get too far off base. Mayor Peterson brings up very, very important points. She's right on. But those aren't the points before us today, and there'll be plenty of other opportunities to explore and defend what she's speaking about. So I don't mean to say they're not important. They're extremely important. It's just not today's discussion.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would agree with the comments made by my colleagues and also by Mayor Peterson in the sense that Well, for me, I guess the most important thing that will be looked at in the environmental review will be water, and that's going to have to be proved up. I think that's really the critical thing, and I think, you know, the applicants know that and staff knows that, so that will be probably the key thing. But I did have a question about the buffer issue, since we do have our Ag Commissioner's office here. I don't know if Ms. Akonike or Mr. Sedevendemi wants to answer this, but the recommendation on buffers here has to do, if either one of you wants to approach it, that would be great. Thank you, Linda. So when we're talking about health and safety in particular here, we're talking about what issues come up in terms of the compatibility between ag and because we do have a fair number of housing developments that combine an ag cluster element to it. So what are we talking about as the main health and safety issues here?
Really pesticide.
The entire vineyard. So there is a difference in pesticide use.
And is there any difference in frequency in terms of practice?
Well, during the season, during the growing season in a vineyard, applications can be made anywhere from 7 to 10 to 21 days, depending on the pest pressure. And primarily that's for disease pest pressure.
Right. And with golf, it's year-round.
It's pretty much.
Yeah. Thank you, Marty. Appreciate it. That's it for right now.
All right.
Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Mr. Hill. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think Mayor Peterson has some very, very valid points, but I do want to I'll go back to Supervisor Ray's point to try to stay on point here with what's before us. And far be it from me to make a determination on anybody's business plan. They know business better than I do, but if they want to try to do this. But I've got some big problems with this from a water standpoint. I mean, we keep pointing to the North County. There's problems in the South County. There's problems on the coast. I guess we'll get into that. If you go through the EIR, that's going to be a very big, big question mark. I don't know whether recycled water has even been suggested on the vineyards. I would think that that would be something that definitely needs to be looked at. But as far as allowing this for processing, I'm not going to hold back in allowing somebody to take a shot at something if they want to do it. It's just going to be, for me, it's going to be a tough battle ahead.
I agree with the frame of your comments there, Mr. Meacham, and maybe we can flesh a couple of more details about some specifics that need to be. But let me recognize Ms. Arnold first, and then I'll give you my comments.
So the things that jumped out in me in both in the very well-done presentations, the landowners could pursue the land use entitlements under the existing specific plan, and then you would update your environmental review, and away it would go. So under that scenario, when I look at what is being proposed today, I'm looking at significantly reducing the size of the resort and then switching from a golf course to a vineyard. So I am familiar with vineyards, and I look at this and I appreciate our ag department being here because I'm also familiar with the incompatibility of residential and agriculture. Very well, very familiar with that. But when I look at this, to me, this is a different. It's more of a unique approach. This is something that's been done successfully in this county as well, with the Varian Ranch and Edna Valley and places where the primary project is still a residential and building the village, and the vineyard will be almost used in a kind of a landscape or a hobby way. Not that the production, I'm sure, will be wonderful, but it's not the same as somebody that is just out there trying to make their dollar on the agricultural production. And I think that's where, when you have two distinct goals that are competing in a way, you sometimes run into problems. But in this case, I'm sure that it'll be almost the opposite. The people that will, as we see in Edna Ranch and Varian Ranch, et cetera, the people that move there, they're moving there because they want to be part of the project, I presume. And I think that, again, fleshing all this out will tell. Maybe the applicants will find out, oh, we didn't know about all that, and we're changing our plans. But it sounds like they just want to take a shot at what this would look like, you know, under the environmental review. So when you talked about the things that, you know, you'll be looking at, water, you'll be analyzing through the environmental review, to address Mayor Peterson's concerns, again, if you're in the vineyard business and that is your focus and you're not even seeing the residential, water can be use of pesticides. All those things are management tools for what you're trying to achieve. If the vineyard is there as a as kind of a secondary part of the project to do some production so that folks can enjoy making wine, et cetera, you can almost do that without any use of pesticides or very little. It just all depends on the management style. And the same with water. The use of water, it varies. It runs the gamut. You can dry farm and use no water on vineyards. And we have some famous grapes, the Ducey Vineyard up in the north, that are dry farmed. That's the way it used to be in the northern San Luis Obispo County. Good wine made, but you just don't get the production that you would if that was your focus and you were trying to make your living on volume, crop volume. So anyway, I think that'll be something we'll see if this comes back, is what the plans are. And again, you can grow grapes with no water. Dust to address that cover crop as well. And all this is just about how you want to manage. And if you want to manage your vineyard so that folks can grow some grapes and make their wine one thing, but you can cover crop it and you can eliminate all the dust if you want to. It might take a little bit away from the vines, but there's your balance. So I'm just interested in the mitigation that comes along with all that. When you talk about the traffic and the visual, I imagine that's going to be more or less the same as what it would have been. In 1998, is it possible to use the reclaimed water from the golf course? I don't know the specifics of the project from before, but using that water for your needed water on the vineyards, and that might be something. The eucalyptus trees, I agree, is something maybe that needs to be discussed because that is a common agricultural practice in windy areas. You see a lot of it on the 101 in King City where the wind blows harder than it does in the dunes, I think. And for hundreds of years, the agriculturists have used the eucalyptus for buffers. And so maybe another something that needs to be part of the discussion. But otherwise, I think it's something that I would welcome seeing you all work through. And I think going back to the ag and the residential, it absolutely can be compatible and has been successfully done in this county. It just needs to be understood by the folks that are moving in. And the again, I believe that in this case, the applicants would be managing the vineyard in a very different way than vineyards that are surely about volume and straight production.
Thank you, Supervisor Arnold. Let me ask a question and offer a couple of thoughts here, and then I'll recognize Supervisor Ray. Question to staff. Ms. Kirk suggested the woodlands was somehow exempt from the level of severity 3 but in that area. But my recollection is that designation applies to the water basin and not to the project. Is that correct? That's not a planning area. It's a water basin designation.
The relationship to weather, the fact that the basin is in level of severity 3 applies to the baseline, which is different from 1998.
Right.
I recognize in 2004, I don't know exactly the application of why it was determined that the Woodlands Village wasn't part of the level of severity 3 or not. But I think it's important to point out the fact that the basin where the water is coming from is in level.
That's the point.
And it's a new day.
So right, exactly. So, you know, Mr. Meacham and others have identified water as the overarching issue. And I think given the situation in the Santa Maria groundwater basin, the situation on the mesa there, I think there's a serious question of whether anything can or should be built under the existing plan or under any modification. There's Supervisor Ray pointed out it's not a matter of whether Vineyard uses less than golf course. Right now there is no draw from phase two of this project on the basin. A golf course potentially could be less of a negative impact on a basin that's already in very serious situation. So given that situation, it seems to me that we're going to have to be, and I should also say, I don't see a reason not to authorize this for processing. As Mr. Meacham said, if the applicants want to proceed at their cost to do this, understanding there's no guarantee of an amendment to the plan as there is no guarantee of a granting of a conditional use permit, I think staff knows that, but for the record, the things that are important from my perspective would be a robust analysis of some elements of our general plan, starting with our strategic growth policies, our housing element, which speaks to the necessity of affordable housing, and our ag element, which has got some very direct guidance as to what, where, how, what, and how we think should go further. As been noted a number of times, this consideration of a general plan amendment, a specific plan amendment, is going to require analysis under CEQA. And part of that, given the sort of assumption that an EIR is going to be required, it should be a robust set of alternatives. The applicant has come forward, although it wasn't so much featured here, with a suggested change to the plan that basically kept the same rather dispersed pattern of housing units sprawling out over that that overall site. I think that alternatives in this analysis, both in terms of the general plan work or specific plan work and the CEQA analysis, needs to look at a better clustering of dwelling units. That could play into an easier job of accommodating reasonable buffers. And, you know, this is a legislative matter, or the start of a legislative matter. But I think that we're far from finished with understanding what's necessary about that. So the clustering, clustering of dwelling units, the buffering, this all in the matter of staff direction, a robust analysis of the balance of housing types. I know that the proposal here changes some residential multifamily units into residential single-family units. I think we need to understand what that does to affordability and the design.
No pesticide? Okay, I'm seeing nods from Shay over there. No need to come to the microphone. It's just, I didn't even think to ask that before just now. And in the under the heading of staff direction and Mayor Peterson's discussion about the removal of eucalyptus, that I think that's a we have learned a lesson that we didn't know in earlier iterations of this specific plan. So definitely part of an updated discussion. I can't believe it's been 16 years already. I was doing the math, and in my head it was only six, and I think I was trying to shave a decade off my own age. But anyway, it's certainly, with regard to whether or not we're going to call the question, it's certainly giving them a shot to update a 16-year-old plan, one that's almost two decades old, I think is definitely something that I would allow. And so I know that there's going to be further discussion, but I think it sounds like we're kind of heading towards alternative two, which is just, I mean, it's essentially number one, but we've given some direction. So I'm thinking that's number two. So
would you like to make that a motion with direction given?
I'd like to wait for the other.
It's just Mr. Meeks. It's just.
I think we have a sense. If you make a motion, I'll be happy to second.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, for clarity, it would be helpful to the motion maker, if it's your pleasure, to distinctly say include crop production as an allowable use, if that's your pleasure or not.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Second on that.
So moved and seconded?
Yes, sir.
All right. Under discussion, Mr. Meeks.
Just a quick comment. And I think I hate to keep belaboring this point, but the issue about water, but we are living in a whole new world. Mm-hmm. I mean, this morning I read an article about the large cities in Brazil that are about running out of water. We're going to have to start thinking more seriously about how we address the issue of growth in our whole county. I'm not an anti-growth guy. I think everybody ought to be able to go where they want to go and live where they want to live. But the resource capability is going to be paramount in the decisions that are going to be made, and not just with this board, but it's going to be made with LAFCO as well. Because as things start to ramp up, we're going to start seeing that. And I, for one, am going to be very, very focused on that particular resource.
And Supervisor Meacham, you're absolutely right on. And while I won't be here for that discussion, I know that, you know, again, as we began this discussion today, we know that that's going to be number one on whatever's coming forward. It just wasn't the question today, but hopefully, I mean, without question, that has to be number one.
Right. With that, we'll go ahead and call the question. Madam Clerk, let's take it on a roll call.
Mr. Chair, may I understand the motion before we go forward? This is option number two, a revised scope, but we don't have to identify any revisions. We just I'm not clear on what the motion is.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you did actually revise the scope. You're keeping crop production. That was proposed by the applicant. You're keeping the option of looking at more houses, which was staff's recommendation.
Right.
I think we've received great direction and issues to consider and to explore. I think truly what you're doing is option one.
Okay. Well, if that's within the scope, then I'll revise my wording.
So it's authorized for processing with staff direction and no modifications to scope. Agreed?
Great.
Ms. Arnold, anything else?
That's all. Thank you.
Let's go with a roll call.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And I'm going to propose we take the next item, which should be fairly short, and then we'll take a break and come back for the last two. Thank you. Madam Clerk, if you would introduce it when you're ready.
Item number 41, a hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend the Administration and Personnel Ordinance, Title II of the San Luis Obispo County Code, relating to the issuance of general plan conformity reports consistent with Government Code Sections 65401 and 65403. The amendment is exempt from CEQA, all districts.
All right. Straight to Ms. Griffin. I can tell she's ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Yes, this should be a relatively quick item. This is a request to amend Title II of the County Code. The reason for the need for this amendment is that currently our County Code actually defines planning agency as the planning department, your board, and the Planning Commission. So every time a government code says that a planning agency needs to do something, really all three of those bodies need to take that action, unless our ordinances are very specific about who the planning agency is. In this case, in 1989, we actually amended this particular statute to identify the planning agency for the purposes of the sale or acquisition of real property by a public agency or the construction of a project by a public agency as the planning and building department. We're asking now at this point to define planning agency for the purposes of determining general plan conformity for your county capital improvement program as your board. The reason for this, it's a streamlining measure. Your board is the one who considers.
Item number 42, a hearing to consider an amendment to the Building and Construction Ordinance, Title 19 of the County Code, changing the requirements of retrofitting and plumbing fixtures in connection with additions, remodels, and new development of residential, commercial, and other structures within the Los Osos Groundwater Basin, District 2.
All right. Mr. Bergman.
I'll let Mike Wolkin do the high-level introduction, and I think Cheryl Cochran there is going to do the details for you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Wolkin.
Thank you, Mr. Bergman. My name is Mike Wolkin. Planning and building staff. To my right is Cheryl Cochran, a key member of our water team, and across from me is Trevor Keith. Today, your board is considering two Los Osos plumbing retrofit ordinances. They are separate agenda items. The first one is the Title 19 retrofit to build ordinance, and the second one that you'll consider after this is the Title 8 retrofit on sale ordinance, both for Los Osos. Both of these ordinances were introduced by your board on November the 4th. On that date, your board suggested a couple of changes that could be made to the ordinance, and in order to make those changes, the ordinances would be need to be introduced or reintroduced today and then set for a hearing at a future date. So with that, I will turn it over to Cheryl Cochran, who will give you some more background and details on the ordinances.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Cochran. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Wolkin. Again, Cheryl Cochran, planning staff. And the item before you now is a proposed amendment to the Title 19 Retrofit to Build program. The Retrofit to Build program was adopted in April of 2008. It was intended to address the level of severity 3 condition in the Los Osos groundwater basin, including seawater intrusion into the lower aquifer. And it required that all new development save twice the amount of water to be used. Today, the Retrofit to Build program is saving an estimated 23,700 gallons per day. That's 27 acre feet per year. And just for context, the average new home uses 150 gallons per day. Additionally, the other program, the retrofit on sale program that we have, is saving an estimated 5,400 gallons per day, or 6 acre feet a year. And an unrelated but an additional program in Los Osos is the Public Works Rebate Program. And they have retrofitted 2,500 toilets with more efficient models. On January 14, 2014, your board provided direction on Title 19, including to exclude the prohibition zone as a retrofit credit source area, and to address how to acknowledge property owners with water conservation certificates in the prohibition zone. These are certificate holders that did a lot of retrofit work and now may not need those certificates. So the main question is, should these property owners who did this work to have the certificates be given some kind of credit for saving that water? These are all of the proposed changes to the Title 19 Retrofit to Build program. First is that retrofit credits must come from outside the prohibition zone. In the past, the prohibition zone was the main credit source area because of the age of the housing stock. Now, most properties in the prohibition zone have already been retrofitted. Additionally, any that have not yet been retrofitted will be required to retrofit before they can hook up to the sewer. So this change is just saying that those retrofit credits must come from the areas not in the prohibition zone. Second change is for urinals in new or remodeled commercial units. As introduced on November 4th, the amendment was for urinals that use no more than 1 gallon per flush, and that was instead of the originally required waterless urinals. Staff was responding to complaints we have heard over the years due to maintenance issues with waterless urinals. However, now to be consistent with the California Green Building Standards Code, we are recommending 1/2 gallon per flush urinals. The next change is to require a retrofit of all existing fixtures with any remodel. The original ordinance states that any remodel involving plumbing fixtures would need to be retrofitted. However, to be consistent with state requirements, we now need to make the change to have retrofit occur with any remodel. And finally, it's to allow a one-time transfer of conservation credits that were issued to properties inside the prohibition zone to specific properties or building permits outside the prohibition zone. This transfer of certificates would provide an option for the 10 property owners who completed retrofit work, saving about 900 gallons per day each, to obtain water conservation. States that certificates can only be transferred in the county is not in a drought emergency, as declared by your Board of Supervisors. Another option for drought designation was listed in the staff report, and that is relying on the U.S. Drought Monitor Report classification of exceptional drought. So I just wanted to highlight the specific changes from November 4th, and that is for shower heads to go from 2.5 gallons per minute to 2 gallons per minute. That is for consistency with Calgreen, as well as for urinals to go from 1 gallon per flush to 0.5 gallon per flush, and that again is for consistency with Calgreen. And for no transfer of certificates during a drought emergency. So those are the new things that we're adding today. And according to council, if your board does wish to move forward with these changes, they do need to be reintroduced today and set for hearing at a later time. Additionally, if your board would like to make any changes to the language that is shown in the attachments, we need to go ahead and make those specific changes today and add the language in. So we will go ahead and look at the actual ordinance text. This that you're looking at now is the same as attachment 3, except that it shows all of the changes in legislative form. So those that were introduced on November 4th are shown in red, and the new changes are shown in blue. So mostly we're just going to look at the new changes. We do have a new map in here. This one will be the permanent one. And it is the same map, however, we're making it a little more clear by darkening the areas of the prohibition zone exception areas. So here you can see the changes to showerheads and to urinals. retrofit credits must come from outside of the prohibition zone. And this is the main change, allowing the transfer of water conservation certificates before January 1st, 2009, except when the county is in a drought emergency as proclaimed by the Board of Supervisors. We did receive notification from a representative of the Los Osos CSD that they would be opposed to the transfer of certificates. Their feeling is that there should not be any additional building in the Los Osos area, even outside of the prohibition zone. And staff's response to that is that this does represent a very significant amount of water. We're looking at 900 gallons per day for each certificate, and the new use would only be 150 gallons per day. And this is water that was saved under an existing program. Additionally, there are only 10 of them, so that's the most that we could see, are those 10 certificates being transferred. Staff recommendation is to reintroduce the ordinance in Attachment 3 and direct the clerk of the board to set for public hearing a date to be determined. And again, Attachment 3 is the same as the one that we just saw. It has all of the changes included. It's just a clean version. That concludes staff presentation, and we're available for any questions you may have.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Cochran. Any questions of colleagues on this matter, Ms. Arnold?
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, thank you for that presentation. And I did have one question. When you talked about if you're moving the transfers out of the prohibition zone for new development, or that can't be done under the county's drought emergency, but then I thought you said or under some other declaration.
Yeah, sorry, that was unclear. There are two options for that. On November 4th, the mention was just for when there is a time of drought emergency. So we see two different options, and one is the county's drought emergency. Mm-hmm. The other is a level D4 from the U.S. Drought Monitor report. D4 is an exceptional drought, so it's just two ways to define when we're in a drought situation.
Okay, good. No, I appreciate that.
Yeah, or both.
That's always good, yeah. Oh, I have one more quick question. Yes. And so just to clarify, there are only 10 certificates that you think are out there?
That is correct. 10 certificates in the prohibition zone.
Okay, and prior to this, and they would be for sale for money outside the prohibition. Is that how it works? I'm not as familiar
with
you all.
Yeah, so they could choose to transfer it to presumably, we do have some minor use permits that are in progress now that are just waiting on their retrofit credits, need to do the retrofit work. So
these certificates would put them into compliance? That would work for
them? Yeah, if hypothetically they purchased a certificate.
They'll be worth the transferring to one property.
They'll be worth one.
Couldn't be transferred to a number of different properties. One time transfer to allow a new property to
use the water. But as a basin savings, what used to be good for 900 gallons a day is now down to 150. So that it represents the savings to the basin.
Yeah, maybe I could help clarify
it
that.
It still would. Okay. Even if it were transferred to allow new development, it would still represent a substantial saving.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
It has already represented a substantial savings in that certificate required saving 900 gallons a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that savings has accumulated over years since we passed this in 2012. What it's worth to the receiving property owner is the opportunity to check a box and build a house.
Okay.
And as staff indicated, it's now at about 150 gallons a day average use for houses. So,
I see. That's not written in as you only get to use 150. You're just assuming gotcha.
And we have
retrofit.
To deal with this on an average basis. The other question of what criterion to use as drought was something that I talked with staff yesterday, and I was playing around with an idea that I think I'll abandon. I think basically the trigger there that these transfers should not go forward when the county has declared a drought emergency is the proper one. I think I don't want to be at the mercy of someone in an unknown location designating exceptional drought or extreme drought. And it was my understanding that the county doesn't have to tag its emergency drought declaration on any specific criterion of the, so we could declare drought emergency at different levels of drought according to the U.S. drought monitor. So I think basically the staff's got it right with the criterion that they have, and I'm comfortable with what it says right now. So with that and no further questions, we'll open it to the public. I have a few requests to speak. We'll start with Amanda Rice, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gibson, Board. Amanda Rice, I'm from Cambria. I'm on the Cambria Community Services District Board, but I'm here speaking just for myself today and not for the district. In reading through both of these agenda items, there were a few thoughts that occurred to me that I'm hoping you will consider in your deliberations on this, on these two items. And although the ordinance is in that packet, in the board packet, it's unclear whether a baseline has been established or if there's a specific target that you're aiming for or a specific time that you're trying to reach, because it seems to me that the amount of time that's gone by since the 2008 ordinance was put into place, a lot of those homes have been retrofitted, and I don't know how much more is available to get retrofitted. It seems I had a question about the new construction requires an inclusion of plumbing for gray water, but doesn't include anything about rainwater catchment. I know in Cambria we have a cistern. We have a requirement for cisterns if a property is over a certain size. And even in dry years, I have a friend who has a rainwater catchment system in Cambria that she still has water from last year, and we didn't get a whole heck of a lot of rain. So that seems to be something missing. It's also silent on landscape and outdoor irrigation requirements for new development, which it would seem to me would be, this is a perfect opportunity to be addressing that if you're addressing new development and the requirements for that. If the properties in the prohibition zone that have certificates have already saved that 900 gallons per day, is that what it is, 900 gallons per day, then, and they would have had to do that retrofitting anyway because of the wastewater treatment plant, does that really save, is that really water saved and not just, because they would have done it anyway, they would have had to do it anyway to connect to the wastewater treatment plant. So I don't see how that is saved water over what would have normally happened just because of the conditions of the wastewater treatment plant. It doesn't really speak very much to how this will help. Obviously, it reduces the amount of water used, but the seawater intrusion is a serious problem, and even reducing, I don't see the connection. If Cambria can't prove that a 2-to-1 retrofit saves water, I'm not sure how this also will help protect the basin in Los Osos. So I look forward to seeing how the board and how your staff handles tracking these to see if the water savings are actually happening, because that's something that we have to do in Cambria. And hopefully this could be a model for what the rest of the county could be doing, and maybe even a model for what could be applied to the rest of the county in terms of really managing our scarce resources appropriately, because it doesn't always rain, and we don't always have all the water we need and want. So thank you.
People have been doing these and collecting these credits. Now, because they may not be able to use them inside the prohibition zone, we're going to move those outside the prohibition zone. And yes, there has been a savings of water for 6 years, if they, all these were, say, done in the first year. A lot of them weren't. But once the wastewater project's done and all those homes are retrofitted, we're talking about eternity. So any of these homes that are built outside the prohibition zone based on these credits is an additional draw on the water source. It was a business decision. I'm sorry it didn't work for them, and they didn't get to build right away or with a promise after the wastewater project in, but it's a business decision. Why those credits should be moved outside of the prohibition zone now is beyond me, because you can't collect credits now inside the prohibition zone for a project outside the prohibition zone because of the requirements of the wastewater project. So because a decision was made, a business decision was made, probably a poor one, or on the hopes that something would happen, there's been some savings of water. 900 gallons a day times 10 certificate, 9,000 gallons a day, didn't make any difference in the prohibition zone as to we need to save. We have needed to save hundreds of acre feet a year, which we have through tiered rate structures, other conservation implementation campaigns in Los Osos. But these two ordinances, this ordinance especially, hasn't made a difference. It's made a very little difference. And once the wastewater project's in, those homes are sitting there outside the prohibition zone drawing water from the basin. 6 years? Where are we in 60 years with that draw? That might not be there if these weren't transferred to outside the prohibition zone.
Thank you, Ms. Margetson. Ms. Tacker, followed by Jeff Edwards.
Good afternoon. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. My first question was the correspondence from the Los Osos Community Services District. That question was never taken in public by the board. So I don't know how they, I haven't seen their correspondence, but I don't know how they came to that decision because it clearly wasn't done in public. I also would ask about the 10 certificates. Were those 10 owners noticed somehow differently? Because I think that would have been prudent to get them down here. You know, Los Osos issues happen all the time, and people don't pay very close attention, but this definitely affects 10 people very poignantly. I think for this item and the next item and some things that the director from Cambria said, there's still water savings available on the table. And when you, in your ordinance, you're specifying shower heads at 2 gallons. I take a shower in a shower head that's 1.5 gallons. And technology is ever coming that it really should just say whatever the state of the art is at the time and not give these 1.28 gallon flush or the 2 gallon shower head. You can still save water just by going to the latest, greatest device. And I think you're leaving water availability on the table for more savings. 17 homes have been built with these certificates, or they will be through outside the prohibition zone because you can't build inside. That's about 3 homes a year. That's all we're talking about. It's not rampant development using these certificates as a tool to develop out Los Osos. It's not happening like that. It's about 3 homes a year. These 10 homes or properties inside the prohibition zone were led to believe that if they had a water certificate and they had sewer service, they could build their home. That's not coming to fruition. And I think you are dancing down a legal minefield for those 10 people. I think the drought is absolutely irrelevant with relation to these certificates. This water was saved, these credits were earned, and they should be transferable so that those very few homes can be built. And others will continue to use the program.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Mr. Edwards?
Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. Good afternoon, board members. My name is Jeff Edwards. I'm a longtime resident of Los Osos. I'd like to speak to the proposed changes to Title 19, the plumbing retrofit ordinance for Los Osos. There have been a majority of homes that have been retrofitted or at least qualified with the 1.6 gallon per flush toilet. There's still a lot of savings on the homes that, quote, have been retrofitted. So hopefully that'll occur over time, and I'm not sure what program, but we need to keep as many programs in place as possible. With regard to the urinal changes, that's fine. The shower head on attachment 6 down to 1.5, I think that's a good change. The requirement for any remodels to retrofit, that's a good one. regarding the one-time transfer for the 10 certificates and the exception for drought emergency drought declaration. I would not support that. I would exclude that from the ordinance. These folks have an investment-backed expectation. They spent money on retrofits. Some of them retrofitted 5 years ago, and that savings has been accruing. So those are my comments. Thank you very much. I am available for questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Let me ask staff a couple of questions. Moving forward with retrofit to build here, you had done an analysis of how many more houses might be available to retrofit. We know it's a fixed sum, and how many are yet possibly retrofit under this program?
I believe there were just over 400 homes that had not been through a retrofit program that we know of, not one of ours. Some of them could have retrofitted on their own, and those are homes that were built after 1994 and are outside the prohibition zone.
And then as to new development, landscaping requirements, you'd referenced that modern construction under Cal Green, typical house using 150 gallons a day. What are the requirements of new development in terms of landscaping and water use? And I know some of that's under development. We have authorized some of that, but currently, right now, how do we regulate that?
Mike Wolkin. Yeah, we have a ordinance requirements in Title 22, and I believe in Title 23 also, that deal with landscaping for new homes. And in general, low water using landscaping is required to be shown on a landscaping plan. We're, as you mentioned, the board authorized us to look at more extensive landscaping requirements, which we're doing countywide
right
now, and we'll be back to your board in the future with some proposals.
Virtually any residential development in the area covered by this ordinance does require a minor use permit, so it is a discretionary action to do.
That's true. And in Los Osos, the outdoor landscaping is not a major component of the total water use. And, generally, you'll find the lower water using landscapes in Los Osos compared to other locations.
All right. I don't know whether staff had any other pressing issues they wanted to respond to from public comment, or whether colleagues had. You do.
We have a couple things we wanted to touch on.
Sure.
If you're bored.
Absolutely. Please.
We did want to mention the Los Osos CSD correspondence was strictly through a phone call after introduction. So no, that was not a public meeting. It was just a direct phone call. Also, the 10 property owners, the owners of those certificates in the prohibition zone, we did send individual letters to them, not specifically about this hearing today. That would have been the normal notification process, but we did let them know that this was up for discussion. And we did want to just address the 1.5 showerheads. I know that was an option in one of the attachments in the staff reports. We did a little further research and also talked with Public Works on this one. We did find that sometimes the 1.5 showerheads, if they're replacing a showerheads that use more gallons per minute, sometimes people will take longer showers, so it seems that this isn't necessarily a savings. Additionally, as we understand, there are sometimes safety issues in older homes who don't have the proper valve to regulate when you have hot water coming in, as in if you use a different fixture, like flush the toilet, there's a valve that regulates that, and sometimes it's not made for the 1.5 showerhead. So that is why we're recommending the 2.0 gallon per minute, also just to stay consistent with Cal Green.
Okay. Very good. So is that your review? And again, I don't see questions for colleagues, so I'll go ahead. I'd like to move this forward. I think staff has gotten it right. I think we have very nicely analyzed and answered the questions that were brought up as we introduced on when at some point in the future vacant lots in the prohibition zone develop, they are not going to need those certificates because of all lot of other things are going to happen that we've talked about already. I do think, however, that there is a reasonable concern on the part of the community and the water purveyors regarding such transfers in the time of drought. We have received new information on the rate of seawater intrusion, saltwater intrusion. It is up. It is likely associated with the drought conditions and the lack of recharge. And so I think the trigger that's in there, that these transfers be allowed to occur as long as the county has not declared a drought emergency, is the right balance in terms of expectations of those who hold them and the impact on the community. So the other only other item was the question of the fact that prohibition zone is going to be retrofit anyway. This program was put in place, this ordinance was put in place 2 years before the permit was approved for the sewer plant, which is what triggers the required retrofit. And so folks proceeded under the assumptions of this program for quite a long time. So with that, I am going to move that we reintroduce this item and set the hearing for February 10th of next year.
I'll second Mr. Chair, can we just clarify that you're reintroducing attachment number 3 to today's
staff? Yes, the language in attachment 3 is presented by staff today.
That's, and when we do take final action on it, there'll be a resolution that accompanies it because of the green building standard.
Excellent. And Mr. Meacham.
Yeah, just a quick, remind me again, going back to the issue of landscape requirements or restrictions, and also Ms. Rice raised a good point about water catchment. Is any of that included in any of the conservation suggestions?
Those items are probably not appropriate for a retrofit ordinance, but it's certainly something we will be looking at as we develop the countywide landscaping requirements that your board authorized us to work on.
Okay. I mean, I can see where landscaping could be a retrofit in a sense. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
My question was just there aren't any landscape requirements that go along with level of 3 severity declarations or catchment or anything like that in the
there are no specified requirements that would go into effect. Those are things that your board could direct us to do in certain areas with as you establish or certify a level of severity 3, and that's one of the things we're doing now is, as your board directed, is looking countywide in the Napomo Mesa Management Area, which is at a level of severity 3, we do have special landscaping requirements in effect just for that area that go beyond what's in the county land use ordinance. Those requirements deal with things like the amount of area of turf that you can have with a development. And so those are more stringent. So that's certainly something that can be implemented on an area-by-area basis or countywide.
Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, and I know this is probably going to Public Works, but an incentive program to do a retrofit from a landscaping standpoint, too, a cash-for-turf type thing. I know we were looking into that. I hope we follow up on that. That could be a possibility.
We are looking at that actively right now.
Thank you, sir. For grass. Supervisor Arnold, anything else?
No.
Very good. So we have my motion and Mr. Meacham's second, a waiving of the, well, I guess we don't have to worry about waiving the ordinance because we're simply reintroducing. And with that, then a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you. And we're going to roll right into the next item. Madam Clerk will introduce. Mr. Wilkin will pick it up, and we're on a roll here.
Item number 43, a hearing for an amendment to the Health and Sanitation Ordinance, Title 8 of the County Code, changing the requirements for sellers of real property within the Los Osos groundwater basin to retrofit plumbing fixtures with water-efficient fixtures at the time of sale, District 2.
Very good. Yeah, let's bypass the middlemen here, get right to Ms. Cochran, who's got the fact. Yeah, cut this management structure stuff. I want to hear from her, okay?
Okay, this item is a proposed amendment to the Title 8 Retrofit on Sale Program. Retrofit on Sale program was adopted in April of 2008, and it required that sellers of properties in the Los Osos area retrofit prior to transfer of title. Today, this program is saving 5,400 gallons a day, or 60 acre feet per year. And on January 14, 2014, your board directed staff to determine the future of the Retrofit on Sale program. In light of the fact that the program has been successful, since reduction are just those two to be consistent with CalGreen. Of course, if any additional changes are made, we must determine specific text today and add it. I will go ahead and show the actual changes. And once again, this is the same as Attachment 3 in the staff report. The brand new changes you will see in blue, and they are just right there, two shower heads and two urinals. We do have the same more clear map as we did for Title 19. Okay. Staff recommendation is to reintroduce the ordinance in Attachment 3 and the rec to the clerk to set for public hearing and action. That concludes the presentation.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Cochran. Questions to Ms. Cochran? Seeing none, we'll open it to the public. We'll start with Amanda Rice, followed by Richard Margetson.
Amanda Rice, Cambria, still speaking for myself and not for the district, although they may agree with the comments that I'm making. Two really quick things. Will the credits for the retrofit on sale be available to people who would like to build new development? And because that was kind of unclear. And then if you're going to exempt homes built after 1994, but you've now reduced the showerhead gallons per minute to 2 from 2.5, your savings over time can be pretty substantial if you're talking about even a five-minute shower, once a day, 5 days a week, you're talking about 7,000 gallons easy per day you could be saving across the all the connections just for the CSD. It does add up really a lot faster than you would think. Just think about when you go to the store, how fast those things can add up. Little small amounts can make a huge amount of difference, even though it's not going to really have a substantial percentage savings over the entire amount, it can make a huge difference. So I urge you to just consider that in your deliberations.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. Mr. Margetson, followed by Julie Tacker.
Richard Margetson. First of all, we don't know exactly how many homes in the prohibition zone have been retrofitted. We know from those that have complied with the retrofit requirements of the wastewater project, and we know those from the retrofit upon sale, but we don't know how many of the rest of the homes are going to need a retrofit. Why would you abandon an ordinance when we've already proven at these meetings repeatedly that the water conservation program for the wastewater project has been deficient in its achieving its goals? It's going to be 18 months till anybody connects to the wastewater project. Then they have to make sure that the retrofits are in. A lot of those homes are going to sell. It's, and this quote about it's a burden on the buyers, sellers, and representatives. It's not a burden. If the cost is being covered by the retrofit program rebates, home inspector does a home inspection. He identifies the fixtures that need to be replaced. The owner calls a plumber. The plumber fills out the form. He submits it to the county. Gets the seller gets the rebate check. That's a burden. This needs to stay in place until the wastewater plant goes online, and people have to start connecting and having and have to prove, those that haven't already, prove that they've done the retrofits. I don't know why there's this rush to get this off the books. Talk about saving water or wanting to save water. This is a way to continue saving water. If the conservation plan for the wastewater project was hitting 90% of its goals at this point, I'd say abandon it. But I think what Chuck Cicina gave you today and the number of times I've talked about how deficient they are in meeting any of the goals so far, I think it's ludicrous to abandon this. It's absolutely ludicrous to abandon this. This saves water, no burden to anyone. Maybe a little inconvenience. You have to pick up the phone and call a plumber. You have to kill cash the check when it comes back from the county. They have to do it eventually. Let's get them to do it as soon as possible. This is a mechanism. When they sell a house, they have to do it. We're 18 months away probably from connecting laterals. Some of those people are going to be even further down the road than that. Keep this in place.
Is that you need that wastewater to move the solids to the plant. Now, how the hell did we build a project that needed that much water to get those solids to the plant? That's the only explanation that I can find. The goal, the overarching issue in Los Sosos has always been the water. And now we're bound up by the wastewater.
Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Board members, again, Jeff Edwards. Fundamentally, the changes or the proposed changes to the retrofit upon sale ordinance eliminate those opportunities in the prohibition zone. I would urge your board to retain the program, the Title VIII program, community-wide. And a couple things. There's an exception in paragraph 8.91.040 that talks about the 1.6 gallon per flush toilet. And I think that we can hold the parties to a transaction to a little higher standard, and I think we can get them to install higher efficiency fixtures. And so I would urge your board, under the exception, to lower that to 1.28 at least, and I think you could actually lower it to 1.1. Along those same lines, I'd have to take exception with your Public Works Department and their evaluation of the 1.5 gallon per minute shower heads. I've had one for many, many years, and I don't find myself taking longer showers. They work quite well, so I just think they're a very good thing. The higher efficiency, the better in all of these aspects. If you're going to, I would urge you to, first of all, consider sunsetting the program in maybe 5 years. Keep it alive for at least five more years, community-wide, until the prohibition zone properties are hooked up. If you're going to do away with the Title VIII retrofit upon sale in the prohibition zone, eliminate the whole program, because I think it's just going to create another layer of confusion in a town that we have a lot of confusion. The realtors are already trained. It is a tool in the toolbox as it is now, and your staff is up to speed. So those are reasons I think you ought to retain the program community-wide. But if you are going to do away with it in the prohibition zone, I'd urge you to do away with it altogether. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. That was our last request to speak, so we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. I wonder if I could get staff to clarify a couple things. One of them is there are not credits associated with this program. It's simply a requirement.
That's correct.
So nobody gets to do anything except retrofit the house. That's just a requirement, and we happen to catch the trigger of sale to do that.
Yes.
Second thing is, on the matter of the fixtures to be retrofit, the requirement is if a retrofit is to be done, the toilet shall be 1.28 gallons per flush, consistent with Calgreen. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But that if there's a 1.6 GPF in there, we're not going to require that be pulled at expense to the buyer or the seller, because the incremental water savings is not significant.
Yes, that's what's in the proposed ordinance.
Okay. And are there any other issues you'd like to touch on based on public comment?
Those were the issues we were going to talk on. Sure. As far as the issue of whether to abandon the program in certain areas or altogether? We'll leave that for your board to discuss.
Very good. And I don't know if colleagues have questions they want to pose. Ms. Arnold?
No, mine was just
okay.
Discussion. So.
Very good. Well, I think we have an ordinance we should reintroduce at this point, starting off the fixture specifications. Again, consistency with Calgreen, I think, is a useful thing. I really honestly don't see that the half gallon per minute on a shower head or the, you know, 0.32 gallon per flush on a toilet is going to make that much difference relative to other efforts that are underway. And it's important to understand that the solution to the seawater intrusion and the groundwater basin balance issues in Los Osos conservation is certainly an important part of it. But it's not the only story. The basin management plan that's being worked on by the water purveyors and the county through the adjudication is going to be the main tool by which we get this condition squared around. Despite Mr. Margetson's continued criticisms, the water conservation plan that's part of the wastewater project has been successful. Staff has analyzed the number of retrofits, but also has estimated the number of houses that won't need to be retrofit because they're already up to standards. And I can't remember the exact number, but something like 75, or maybe it's even as high.
To me, it's a problem with something more important, and that is that we are we're prohibiting a free market sale of someone's possessions. Now, I would be very supportive of a voluntary program, taking the opportunity when to educate sellers and or buyers that when there's a transaction being done that there are programs available for them to retrofit at that time. But the requirement, I have problems with that. And I would rather look at something. First of all, I'm going to ask again, or just at least pass a comment, that I would love to have a public informational program on what the severity of the saltwater intrusion is and what other things we can do for that whole area to try to solve this problem in another way. Again, voluntary programs, educating people about them, urging them to participate, but not mandatory retrofit on sale.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, I'm still not clear on why we would get rid of this as it is. I'm still not real comfortable with that. Can you help me out there a little bit? Why we would do away with a program that seems to me has in place the ability to address the conservation issue?
Mike Wolken, planning staff. The rationale is that most of the retrofitting has occurred within the prohibition zone. We've got anecdotal evidence from the plumbers that are working out there that they're just not finding the houses to retrofit, and that there is some administration that's needed to run this program. So the question is it worth it for the few remaining retrofits that might be out there to continue the program in the prohibition zone, whereas outside the prohibition is probably where most of the remaining retrofit candidates are going to be. We identified about 400 possible candidates outside the prohibition zone. Some of those have probably, or many have probably, retrofitted already. So there's a declining pool of candidates to be retrofitted in Los Osos, and actually that's a good thing because when the programs have worked, you're not going to be left with many houses to retrofit, and so that's the rationale for excluding the prohibition zone as a source area for the credits. Yes, there are some left to be retrofitted probably, but the plumbers that we deal with are not finding them very easily.
I guess, but I still don't understand, though, that if there's some still there, and how are we or are we aggressively trying to address those, or are we just waiting for people to come forward? I mean, to me, I don't understand where the staff difficulty is here with this.
It takes some time, staff time, to administer the program, and so there's... it's just a matter of whether it's worth it for the few remaining. It's
well, I guess we're weighing staff time versus water savings.
Yeah, it's certainly up to your board whether or not to continue it. But that was the original direction that we got, was to consider discontinuing it in the prohibition zone and focusing outside the prohibition zone.
May I respond to that,
yep.
Mr. Meacham? I mean, the houses inside the prohibition zone are going to get retrofit anyway. We estimate that the vast majority of them are already up to the retrofit standard that we need. And so what staff has to effectively enforce this program is to track when sales occur, where those homes retrofit. It does pose an administrative burden. When staff first brought this forward in conversations with me, they wanted to do away with this program altogether. And I can understand the rationale of the amount of staff effort relative to the amount of actual water savings, but I didn't feel, especially in this time of drought, you know, especially as we're not yet with a basin management plan, that we should abandon it where it has a chance to actually accomplish something, and that's outside the prohibition zone. So within a year to 18 months, we will have the entirety of the prohibition zone retrofit. But outside, there's no, right now, specific requirement to go in and retrofit an existing home. We use the trigger of sale as one way of doing that, and we can enlist the real estate community to help us get there.
Well, I mean, I understand that aspect of it. I mean, outside the prohibition zone and trying to trigger on sale, how that works. But I
sure.
still don't understand why we're excluding the prohibition zone. If they're going to do it anyway, then they're going to be reporting that.
Well, I'm amenable to putting the language back in to keep it in place in the prohibition zone. You know, my effort was to free up some staff time, but if it's the interest of the majority of this board, I'll certainly modify my motion to keep it in place inside the prohibition zone. And
well, I guess the fundamental question for me is it safe if it's going
regarding where
good luck seeing that
where the there we go. That's good. Where the retrofitting would take place. And so it says all existing residential, commercial, and other buildings that receive water from the Los Osos groundwater basin and were constructed prior to 1994 and then strike the and are not located in the prohibition zone.
And I will modify my motion to make that correction to the language that staff introduced and any other cleanup if we don't need to define prohibition zone anymore in this ordinance, whatever clerical issues need to accompany that for consistency.
We need to be absolutely specific about the changes we're going to make if we're going to reintroduce it. So just to be clear, we're talking about Attachment 3, today's staff report. Is that the one we're working off?
It looked to have Attachment 4 written on it, but
that's correct.
This is the same as Attachment 3. It just has the legislative changes shown.
Okay, so it is Attachment 3. We're going to make that strike. Does staff want a couple of minutes to go through the ordinance to see if we need to do anything else to make everything particular?
If we could maybe take a break for 5 minutes,
sure.
So we could look through the ordinance and make all the changes, that would be
appreciated. Let's get this right.
Appreciated.
Okay, so we're recessed for 5.
Yeah. We're live.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wilkin, you want to
set
the record straight here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we'll walk you through the changes that are needed so that the program applies everywhere in the community within the groundwater basin. So in section 8.91.010C, what we're recommending is to strike the last sentence in C that says, as a result, the retrofit on sale program should now target older housing within specific areas, since we're not targeting specific areas.
Okay.
And then on section 8.91.020E, that subsection should read, the Los Osos groundwater basin is shown in Figure A. So we're deleting the reference to the prohibition zone. That's not necessary now. And then the map should be in the proposed ordinance should be replaced with this map, which is the existing map. It does not show the prohibition zone.
Okay.
Or does not call it out.
Yeah, it doesn't specify it. Okay.
And then on section 8.91.030A, this one we already went over, we are deleting the words and are not located in the prohibition zone so that all existing residential, commercial, and other buildings that receive water from the Los Osos groundwater basin shall be retrofitted with low consumption plumbing fixtures, et cetera.
Okay.
And those are the changes that are needed.
Very good. Thank you. Council, concur?
Yes, we do. Those are changes to attachment 3 in the staff report.
And there were other changes that we talked about earlier in the first staff report that changed from 4th as to the specs of urinals to a half gallon and shower heads to 2 gallons per.
That's correct. And those specific changes were reflected in what Mr. Wilkin just flashed on the screen for you. So they're in there as well.
So we're square. Any other questions from colleagues? Seeing none, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
And Ms. Arnold?
No.
Thank you very much, everybody. That concludes today's meeting, and we'll see you
Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, indeed, and we'll see you next week.